So, welcome to episode 65 of Striking Mike with Self Striker.
How you doing, everyone?
So, we got a lot to cover today. We're going to go over the European elections. I think that's the first item on the agenda, and we maybe have some bottom of the stack items towards the end of the show that we want to cover. But let's start with the EU elections. I think a lot of people know about Britain and Sargon and UKIP. We're going to get to that. I want to talk about that. But let's talk about the meds. Let's talk about the Italians first, because Striker, I think, probably has information on that a lot of Americans might not know. So let's talk about Italy.
Well, okay. So the government in Italy is the League and the Five Star Movement. And, you know, they've done some good things, particularly on the immigration front. But I wouldn't get too excited about the fact that the League won the top position in the European elections. I'll tell you why. They have actually I'm starting to get some PTSD from them. Post-Trump stress disorder. So here's some background. In the last few weeks, the League's main regional ally, which was it was Heinz Christian Strache in Austria from the Freedom Party. He was a vice chancellor. He got overthrown in an intelligence service coup. The main chancellor, who was just some conservative, also I believe resigned the other day. And this was all based on forgery and lies, and so it's clearly political. The Austrian government's own intelligence services deposed them. So what does that mean? Well, that means Italy has no regional allies other than Marine Le Pen's party, who did win a lot of seats for the European Parliament, but have no actual power in France. So Salvini is in a bind. Because I know your narrative, Mike, it's not a narrative, it's what you think, is that it's good news that the institutional conservatives and social democrats were chased out in a year of record turnout. And I totally agree with you. That is great news. You know, the fucking parasites associated with Merkel and Macron and May were thrown out. And now they've been elected to seek employment to sell perfume with the Africans in the outskirts of Brussels. So that's what they're going to be doing now. They're out of work. You know, these fucking parasites, they go to Brussels, they don't do diddly shit, and they make a lot of money doing it. They're not going to do it anymore. That's great news. With that said, though, there's also bad news. So that's the good news. Here's the bad Jews. Golden Dawn and NPD lost seats. Okay, and people can say that, you know, NPD is this or that. I get the criticisms and so on, but here's the thing. In Germany, NPD is the only actual political party that ran on not just opposing immigration to zero, but also deporting them.
Yeah.
There's millions of blacks and Arabs in Germany that are there as refugees under false pretenses. And the only party that is actually calling for deporting them was NPD. NPD made a very clear policy announcement where they said, we're fine with women and children from Syria staying in refugee camps in Germany, but the war in Syria is over. We have to send – and on top of that, these are mostly young men anyway, they said.
Yeah.
We have to send all these people back, they said. AfD is not for that. They are not for that. So one thing that, you know – from talking to various people in Europe and so on, and reading things in different languages too, that's, you know, you have to really get both sides of the story. You have to read the other side, stuff that may not trickle into America, because right. Obviously the English speakers tend to be more, I don't know how to say it, like maybe English speakers in Europe tend to be more American and Americanized, so they see things even slightly different than an actual person that is just a regular Italian nationalist and so on. My point is, though, is that you have to be wary of these Euro populist movements, whether it's UKIP or AfD or Sweden Democrats or the league, because all of those parties are actually libertarian parties. This is something that is never talked about.
Yeah, well, I mean, UKIP is, I mean, I know more about that. I would actually, well, whatever, we can talk about UKIP in a minute, but I agree with what you're saying generally. Well, what I'm, my thing with UKIP is that UKIP started absolutely as a libertarian party, and Nigel Farage was always a libertarian. And Nigel Farage, actually, for people that got, I think Brexit Party was a much bigger threat in terms of this than UKIP was in this election. In fact, higher UKIP turnout and lower Brexit Party turnout would have been better news for us, despite Sargon and Milo doing their antics. Because Gerard Batten is a more of a nationalist than Nigel Farage was. And even the reason that Farage abandoned and cut the knees off of UKIP and decided to trash the party was because they included Tommy Robinson, and then they included specific. Now, I know we talk about the issue of making anti-Islam your only policy, but they made specific kind of like anti-Muslim provisos in their party constitution, to the extent that they legally can do that in the UK. So they were kind of positioning themselves as a harder core party when initially they were a libertarian party. And in fact, Farage's goal was less European immigration and more Commonwealth immigration. And the British Commonwealth
I'm sorry to say, but that's UKIP's goal too.
Well, okay, I'm not.
Which on the other side of that, the UKIP also had a splinter, because you know that UKIP has a policy where if you were ever a member of the British National Party at any point in your life, you're not allowed to join UKIP. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. Well, it doesn't surprise me that I have been told, and it could be wrong, from people that are in the UK that Gerard Batten was trying to reform that stuff, and this is why Farage cut that party off at the knees. But look,
there's another split from UKIP called the For Britain movement.
Yes.
Which is run by Anne-Marie Waters, UKIP.
That is
because
a specifically,
of how cut they were. Yeah.
But that is a specifically anti-Islam single issue party, the way Brexit Party is single issue Brexit. Anne-Marie Waters is getting more based, if you will. She's becoming less purely anti-Islam and more pro-white,
rather,
so to speak. Before, Britain didn't even really run in this election. I didn't see any results.
They ran all right. They didn't do very well because they're small and have meager resources, and they're also new. But Morrissey endorsed.
Well, that also, I mean, you know, Morrissey was banned from the biggest record store in Britain, the biggest record store chain, because of this. So, look, we're getting off topic.
Well,
I didn't want to go.
This is all relevant because the point I'm getting at here is these right liberal populists. That's what I call them, because that's what they are.
Yes.
It's like we were talking about last week. Remember when we were talking about how these groups always signal about Judeo-Christian values in Israel when no one asked them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you want to talk about optics, and people will say, well, they're just trying to do good optics. Well, actually signaling in favor of an aggressive pro-Israel pivot is terrible optics
and
in Europe.
And not only that, it's even worse than that with Nigel Farage, who openly says he wants Brexit so that they can bring more blacks to London. Who runs on a policy of bringing more blacks anywhere? I mean, look, I'm sorry, but it's true. What politician would stand up? I mean, we are at a point where that is not something that you do because it's popular or for optics' sake or to get support and then change. Because
it's Trump
not popular.
Doing something similar in America.
Yeah, not popular. So why do you do that? It's a sign of submission.
It's a sign that you're not looking to please your voters. You're looking to please someone else.
Yes.
Who is that? That's the question.
Yes, exactly. So
that's the question. So the because Donald Trump right now, not to get off topic, but this is also relevant because it's in that Donald Trump is in that world. He's in that world of right liberal populists.
Well, Farage reminds me exactly of Trump, of the trajectory that Trump took. It's it's very similar that he and Farage is probably even a little bit more dangerous because he is funny and charming and charismatic and seems like a cool guy, whereas Trump is kind of just a dumbass. But like, yeah, no, it's the same exact thing. It's, and I think, you know, my view is that the Brexit Party did single issue specifically as a way of defusing nationalist sentiment. And whatever UKIP's, and I know you got all these criticisms of UKIP, but, and I'm not trying to like shill for UKIP or anything, but if that was too radical for Farage, such that he had to split off and form the Brexit Party, you know, there was something going on there. It was starting to become a lightning rod. And some people in Britain have told me this as well, that, you know, the surface level. But again, that's also like, well, you know, is that a good vehicle or not? That's a debate that it's not really for me to chime in on. That's for people in Britain to decide. But the point
of the For Britain movement was to actually, it's specifically to fill the void that the British National Party left.
Yes.
The British National Party actually was
popular.
It was popular, and it's exactly how you resist this. The British National Party was fervently anti-capitalist. It was ethno-nationalist, not anti-Islam necessarily, although towards the end it started becoming an anti-Islam party and stuff like that. But, you know, Nick Griffin learned his lesson, because – if you watch his last year in the European Parliament, he gave a very famous quote or thing. He got up in the middle of the Parliament when they were talking about something, and he said, this immigration project to replace the white Europeans is a product of the Zionists and the capitalists. And and the, you know, there was like the moderator, the judge in the Parliament was like, Mr. Griffin, this is racist.
Well, then it happens.
It's really good. You can watch it on YouTube. But anyway, the point I'm making is that the British National Party's downfall and replacement with UKIP simply left a huge vacuum. So the point I'm making – I'm actually finishing up an article about this. Is the point I'm making is finance in our liberal plutocracies has gotten so bloated and so big that it's – that the state is almost powerless. That's why if you compare white populists from 50 years ago, from Juan Perón to Charles de Gaulle, who weren't really racist, but they were nationalists. Those guys were army men. They were men that served the state, right, in an official military capacity. Those were the populace back then. Why? Because back then, the state was more powerful than capital. Today, the white populace are Nigel Farage, from the city of London, the man's a lifetime banker. Steve Bannon used to work for Goldman Sachs. Donald Trump, a real estate speculator. These are our populace now. And why is that? It's not necessarily – so I'm not going to go with the full conspiracy theory thing that they're shills and this and that. You know, they may well be. But what I think it is, that just reflects how the power structure has totally changed in the West, that the only people that can even participate in politics in any capacity are people that are tied to the bankers and to big capitalists.
Yeah.
You know, I'm no fan. I said this on Twitter. I'm no fan of Dwight Eisenhower. The man murdered millions of Germans for no reason. With that said, look at his government. Again, Dwight Eisenhower, former general, became president of the United States. Very – probably the strictest immigration enforcement in American history came on his watch. There was a planned – far more economic planning.
Well, there's massive infrastructure project built.
There's more central planning. There was a 70% – there was a 70% capital gains tax under Dwight Eisenhower. Yeah.
And also the building of the interstate system and the claim at the time – and, you know, libertarians still attack it for this reason, was that it was to move the military very quickly. But in fact, it ended up being a massive subsidy to capitalists because it gave them a delivery network for all their products that was essentially paid for through the taxes of the public.
The libertarian thing that's about moving the military is also argued with the Audubon. Yeah. And There's not even a shred of evidence used for military purposes.
The military uses it, but it's like the purpose of it was a massive subsidy to capital. It was a massive distribution network for products.
Like all infrastructure, it's to enable movement.
Right.
Like that's what it was. And if it has the periphery benefit of helping to move
I'm not against the interstate highway system. I'm not, you know, I'm not against it. But it's, yeah, no, I mean, of course, obviously it's going to facilitate the movement of goods, whether
right, but the point I'm making, though, is that Dwight Eisenhower is a great example of what policy looks like when it's informed by the state, when the state is in charge of the economy. Right. Or more powerful than the economy.
I mean, he also told the Jews to go fuck themselves over the Suez, but that was,
right. But that, yeah, that's what it looks like when a government actually serves its people, at least in some capacity. They might have to juggle with business interests and so on. But, you know, if you look at Juan Perón, Charles de Gaulle, and Dwight Eisenhower, all of them were army men, military men. They wore military uniforms. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what has changed? Why do we have populists now that pay lip service to policies that are unpopular? Why do we have Nigel Farage talking about importing
the entire
Commonwealth to Britain? I mean, say what you want. You may be British. You may hate the Polish, whatever your problem is. But you know what? They're not Nigerians.
Right. I mean, it is, I think, of an interesting question to examine. And I think that that's where we should focus the discussion, is why does Farage do that? Why does Trump do the crime bill thing? I mean, yesterday on Twitter, Trump was going out and dragging Joe Biden, because even in 1994, Joe Biden, who's a complete empty suit and a shill and will say whatever he needs to, because that's what he's – I mean, he's changed positions so many times. He obviously has no principles. So in 1994, he went out and he said, look, I don't care why it is that this person is a predatory criminal. I don't care if they're a product of society. I just want it dealt with. And he said that as a Democrat. And it was popular. And they passed the crime bill. Today, Trump, the fascist, is counter-signaling that for being racist. I don't know what fucking Jew strategist in the back room told, because it's not just Trump. Other GOP figures were doing this yesterday, too. So this was a strategy that they had gotten from, you know, I'm sure Jewish consultants somewhere, to go out and do this and make this DR3 argument on the internet, and it is a fucking disgrace.
Well, the argument, I always go back to this, when Joe Biden was saying those things in the 1990s, the state was still more powerful than it is today. I mean, you know, the conservative argument is that the problem is that there's too much government. It's the fucking opposite. The problem is that there's not enough government to write. I mean, you know,
the government is huge and oppressive, but there's no way for people's sentiments and what people really want to intrude on its operation. And we discovered that. And it seems like that becomes more, as it actually does get bigger. And you know, the socialism for the rich, as we say, it gets more intense. The ability for people to change things that are wildly unpopular, and the inability for the state to even grant minor concessions that are popular, is amazing. Like a wall. But I mean, a wall is not expensive. Yeah. They could easily have done it. And if
the mistake,
but they didn't.
Though, where I would argue against you, though, is that just because the state has become repressive doesn't mean that the state is powerful. Okay, because you know, the state is used as an instrument of finance to oppress people. It's not a thing in and of itself. I mean, it's like Joseph Goebbels said. He said it very well. He said, you know, if you're an anti-communist, the only way to fight communism is to destroy capitalism, because communism is a response to abuses from finance. That's why people – even he said the German worker that joins a communist party is not doing it because he hates his fatherland. He's doing it because he hates the same traitors, the bourgeois traitors that are destroying his fatherland. So what I'm saying here is that, you know, Bill Clinton passed that crime bill because there was an expectation that you have to make some concessions to your voters.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the reason why the crime rate has plummeted since 1994 is largely due to that crime bill.
Yes.
So Donald Trump is literally running on more crime. The one thing Republicans usually get right, law and order, he can't even do that right.
They can't do it right. They've specifically
who's making policy then?
Yeah.
Because, you know, even black people, say what you want about black people. So sure, there's that 30 or 40% of the black community that's like, yo, this nigga gonna let me steal cars now? Oh, shit, I'm a vote, you know. But a lot of black people don't want to be shot by gangbangers.
Well,
they don't want.
Overwhelmingly, police calls come from blacks. You know, so the whole idea of fuck the police and shit is, well, certainly a lot of blacks have that attitude, but you know, that's the criminal, and look, their criminal class is very large in their community, but it's true. But blacks call the police more than anybody too, so it's like, fuck the police is like, whatever. I mean, the point, I think, I don't want to get into an autistic debate over state and capital. I think the whole thing is a complex. I think
that is the main debate. I mean, why do you?
You're missing my point. You're missing my point. I think the whole thing is a complex that serves the interests of the financial elite. That's what it is. So I guess, you know, you could, I agree with your point, but I wouldn't say that it's like, that people don't experience the state as like not having power. People experience it as a thing that's there and is very powerful, but is never going to serve their interests. And that despite their best efforts, despite participating in the process, despite being active, they will get disappointed, betrayed, and let down again and again if what they want is something that is going to ultimately be good for the people and not for the big financial interests, like something like socialized healthcare. What did we get? We got a handout to insurance companies, right? So I understand your point, but
it's not socialized healthcare, though.
I didn't say it was socialized healthcare. You're missing my point. That's what people wanted. That's popular policy. What we got was something that was feigning that, but was in fact a big handout to insurance companies. You see my point? That's why, like, you cannot get the policy you want, even if it wouldn't be a burden on them to give it to you. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. So the reason I bring up the power of finance capital over the state, because
I'm not disagreeing with that.
Way things work is that the state is more powerful. I mean, that's the agreement. The state oversees commerce. Commerce doesn't oversee the state, right? So the point I'm making here is that it's no surprise that the parties that are seizing on the zeitgeist in Europe against immigration are libertarian parties.
Right.
Okay. AFD, UKIP, Sweden Democrats. These are parties that have, at the very least, a trajectory of being libertarian. I mean, the League, Lega Nord, that was their name in the 90s. They were regionalist. They were for privatization. They were for drug liberalization. They were even for gay marriage in 1990s Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the five-star movement is also tax cuts for billionaires. Excuse me?
Five-star movement is also for gay marriage.
Sure, but they're on the left or whatever. Like, no one voted for them on immigration issues or as right wingers. The people voting, Matteo Salvini goes out there with a rosary in his hand. Okay, but I'm not saying that the League hasn't changed. Just like UKIP, they have changed on some of these issues. But you know that that ideological heritage of the party, the fact that they were the ones to rise to take the votes of the anti-immigration sentiment, you can't separate that from their past. They have been in power before. They had a coalition government with Berlusconi. Okay, so what I'm saying here is to you don't have to be neurotic or schizophrenic, but you have to tread with caution. You can't go full in with these people. You have to support if you want to support them. It's got to be critical. Support them when they do good things, but you have to criticize them when they do bad things.
I was getting a lot of pushback for my. I basically went on the attack against Nigel Farage yesterday on Twitter, and I was getting pushback. And I get it. Like maybe I was just telling Americans, I was like, look, if you're American and you haven't really been paying attention, you just like Farage for the memes. Just look into it and you'll see that I'm right. And, you know, a lot of people were like, after they did look into it, like, oh shit.
Yeah. So in the case of the League, which I know a lot about, so right now, as people know, they have a coalition government with the left wing populists and the Five Star Movement. So a lot of things that people like about the League, like, you know, Salvini announced that he was going to prove the Italian birth rate by giving family stipends and so on. Those ideas came from the Five Star Movement. Those don't come from the League. Okay, those are things that the left populists contribute to this syncretic coalition government, left-right coalition government. On top of that, the Five Star Movement is also important because they kind of temper Salvini and the League's cuckier elements. For example, the five-star movement is pro-Palestinian. So when Salvini Salvini went to Israel and was calling for action against Hezbollah, the Islamic terrorists.
Which is like, why the fuck?
Well, not just why the fuck. What the five-star movement said, they yanked his chain and they said, you realize that we have Italian soldiers stationed in Lebanon. Why are you antagonizing the Hezbollah? Why do you want Italian soldiers to be engulfed in the coming Middle East conflicts? Because the Italian voters certainly don't. So why are you talking like that to suck Netanyahu's dick? Why? What does Italy get out of that? And that's something that is tempering them. And the bad news of the European elections is that the five-star movement did very poorly. They lost half of their seats, by the way. Mm-hmm. So even though that doesn't affect their power inside of the coalition government now, like I was telling you in private, you're going to start seeing Jews in the Financial Times doing stuff like, oh, why doesn't the League purge the five-star movement or depose them from the coalition and form a new one with Berlusconi and his, cucked goons?
Yeah.
You're going to start seeing that more and more because they what I say in my article is that the five-star movement after this European vote is like, they still have their spot, but they're like the granny in the strip club. That's their bargaining power. So, it's very important to know this. Another thing too is that Salvini has betrayed the campaign promise of a European Union exit referendum. So he ran on the League ran on this. They promised a Brexit style referendum, and they're not going to deliver. Salvini said that he's given that idea up, and what he wants to do instead is to, quote, reform the European Union. What does that mean? Well, he put out his first idea after the election the other day. He said, the first thing we're going to do is we want to reform our tax policy.
Yeah.
So Salvini has this libertarian tax. He wants to give the billionaires in his country a Trump tax cut, essentially. That's what it is. And the European Union has regulations against that because, of course, that's a destabilizing policy that will make an already bankrupt Italy even more bankrupt. Yeah, they're going to lose 100 billion euros if they push this through.
And so people understand – we talked about this a little bit yesterday too. This is something important for people to understand that in the United States – you know, we've talked about MMT and how the debt system works and the printing press and et cetera. And my opinion is that the debt system is kind of a Rube Goldberg machine to cover the fact that the government can just print money and that the only constraint on the government's money printing power is inflating the currency too fast. And that really what happens is that this is a system so that the government can print money, create inflation, and Jews can skim off the top. But that doesn't change the fact that in America, tax revenues are far less important than they are in a country like Italy, because Italy gave up the power of the printing press to the European Central Bank. So when you, as a government, can't print your own money, cutting taxes is a potentially disastrous move. Whereas in the United States, it's not.
Yeah, and on top of that, when it comes to an italicsit or whatever you would call that,
increasingly weird words for this. Yeah, italicsit.
70%. There was a Gallup poll last year that said 70% of Italians say they are poor since joining the European Union.
They are because it seriously restricts the economic liquidity to hand over. Now, they literally have to borrow money from the central bank, and then they have to pay it back. So if you cut the reason that EU has these, they're like, well, if you can't pay back your EU central bank loans, then we have to decrease your credit rating, and then you're fucked.
Exactly. And so, long story short, that ridiculous flat tax idea Salvini has conjured up. Again, no one asked for this. No one voted for the League to do this. That's being done under – so the reason they're backing off leaving the European Union is largely because Italian capitalists and multinationals don't like the idea. They've essentially vetoed it. And even though 70% of Italians say they're worst off under the European Union, a lot of the big businesses are better off because they get to be integrated into the German economy and so on without any borders or tariffs. And on top of that, the second thing, that the tax cut for billionaires, again, no one voted for that. Now, the Five Star Movement will probably veto that law, but who knows? Okay. So the point I'm getting at here is that, you know, what I do in the article is I compare it to a timeshare scam, right? So what they do is they say, okay, we're going to give you what you want on immigration. We're going to protect industry. We're going to say a fuck you to Brussels. But you're going to have to sit down for an hour and listen to my pitch about a Tel Aviv timeshare. That's how they do it. You know, you have Salvini going out there talking about Judeo-Christian values.
Yeah, he's been doing a lot of, I mean, and I remember, you know, I've been following him on Twitter and hitting the translate button. So, you know, usually when I look at stuff in Italian, I'm like, am I looking at a list of ingredients? But no, I'm joking. But you can follow him and hit translate and look at what he's actually saying. And it's not as base as you might think. And I agree, like, I like what they've done with immigration. And if reports are true, they've seriously reduced the migration. That is the origin of Salvini's popular power, because he does post videos of himself all over Twitter all the time, constantly going out, and crowds are coming up to him. Women are giving him hugs and kisses. People are shaking his hand. That's because of the immigration stuff. That's not anything having to do with a tax cut or putting troops in, you know, like fighting Hezbollah or anything like that. No one's running to give him a kiss and a hug because of that. They're doing that because, like, thank you for getting these people out of our country.
Well, let me red pill you on that, Goy. So, Salvini has done a lot of good stuff symbolically in turning back the NGO ships and so on. That's a great thing.
But I mean, you would agree with what I'm saying about this is the source of his ability to go out.
That is 100% the source of why the League is in power now. That's 100%. But let me clarify some things. So the real reason why immigration has fallen to Italy and to Europe in general is because it's not because of Salvini alone, really. It's because Britain and France and Germany are paying African dictators billions upon billions of dollars to keep their people from leaving. This has been happening for the last 2 years. There was a project the European Union Fund started in 2015, but it really kicked up in the last 2 years. So you have like this dictator in Sudan or whatever, however the fuck you say it, who's basically like his people are trying to leave the country. He's just gunning them down. Because the EU is paying him. So that's the real reason the immigration problem has been falling, because the liberals themselves have turned the spigot off.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Because they were suffering domestically. I mean, you know,
well, it was hugely destabilizing.
So what they're doing now is they're focusing on absorbing these immigrants and also staving off a nationalist opposition, which, you know, even though there was some good news in the European elections, they have staved off a major nationalist influx.
Yeah. And the reminder that when you listen to almost every conservative talk about immigration, they always focus on, and this goes back to our critique of Islam only as your focus when it comes to this, rather than immigration, to be Islam focused rather than immigration focused, is that what happens is that these people subtly shift their rhetoric to be, well, look, the issue isn't that their religion is too hardcore. They don't assimilate. They form enclaves, blah, blah, blah. Right. And so it seems like they're striking some kind of anti-immigrant tone because they're not doing the crazy anti-white stuff that the leftists do. But in fact, what they're doing is more insidious in a way, because they're saying, look, we're going to absorb these people. We got to bring them in and make sure that they all start fitting in and become good workers in the economy and stuff. And that's the conservative immigration policy, and that's what they have pivoted to rather than a restrictionist policy. They're like, look, we're going to dial this back for a minute, get these people situated, and then we'll turn it on again when we feel like it.
Well, let me continue. So Salvini is not pushing for sweeping deportations. He's not pushing to repatriate these people back to Africa or the Middle East. What he's fighting for is an end to the Dublin Agreement. So for some context, the Dublin Agreement says that the first European country you step on, if you're an asylum seeker, as they say, is a country that has to house you. And this obviously puts a massive burden on southern European countries because right. that's the first country they step on. So Viktor Orban has actually largely distanced himself from Salvini because Salvini's solution to the millions and millions of blacks and others in Europe is not to deport them, but to, quote, share the burden across Europe. So a country like Hungary that has – it's basically landlocked. They have no incentive to support that because they're building walls all around their country and like no one's getting into their country. But if Salvini gets his way, the EU is going to resettle some of these refugees in Hungary, in Poland, in Romania, in places that don't want them. So that's not very based, friend. That's not very good. Because his thing is he wants to keep the immigrants in Europe, just not all of them in Italy. Why isn't deporting them on the table? The war in Syria is over, and most of them aren't Syrian either.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea that they were Syrian, that went out the window a couple of years ago. But, I mean, that was the whole Syrian refugees thing that died a few years ago. Now they just started calling them migrants and things like that, and they don't even bother to explain why it is that they're going to Europe. But yeah, no, it does seem that it's not, and the thing is here, it's not like that wouldn't be popular, right? Like Salvini could go out and say, let's deport them all, and it would be wildly popular. I mean, the fact that people are under the impression, and even probably some people in Italy are, you know, maybe low information or not paying attention, are under the impression that Salvini is the great deporter is why people love Salvini.
Right.
It's not, so if he's not even doing that, And you know more about this than I do. I had the impression until you red-pilled me on this that Salvini was doing great and that he was out there deporting people and that this was his agenda.
He is deporting some people, but the bulk, the people that are already inside or have been inside for the last 3 years awaiting their asylum hearing or whatever, he's not for deporting them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would assume that his claim would be that European rules don't allow him to. But then what I would say is that, well, if European Union rules don't let you do that, why is your first order of the day for reforming European rules a tax cut for billionaires? Yeah. Why don't you make that your first rule?
Yeah. And if you're making a platform out of ending the Dublin Agreement, then European rules aren't set in stone. So, you know, obviously you have some influence there. And on top of that, you could say, all right, this is something you could start attacking the European Union for that. I mean, this is the thing. This is also why I think people should stop doing the thing of reading into and trying to put like 4D chess or best case scenario spins on thing, because you could say, well, Salvini is doing what he has to. He's working within a framework that he's not totally under control of. So he's got to do this. Why doesn't he just tell that to the people? Right? Like I'm saying, like, if he's constrained by the EU in certain ways because of legal agreements and this or that or whatever, go out and tell that to the people. See, like, look, we're working on this, but we have to fight through the EU. We're doing this, and this is the approach. Just tell that then no one, it's not a mystery. Then you don't have to start doing this reading into, and people do this with Farage all the time. Oh, he just said that about, because in 2016, he said, we need more blacks in Britain. That's why we're doing Brexit. And people, oh, he's saying that cause he has to. I'm like, who, why does he have to?
Why?
Who does he have to say that to?
What does that do other than
literally
losing votes?
Nobody wants that. Like that, you know, and so who? Well, somebody does, but it's not the people that are going to vote for Brexit. So why is he saying that? And it's not just like if to own the libs. Why is he saying that? Like doing? Oh, he's doing a clever DR3. No, he's not. Why is he saying that? So that's a thing that I think people have to adjust their thinking about this and stop doing the hopeful best case scenario. What you think this guy is doing, and start just acting on what they are saying they're gonna do.
and what they're doing.
And what they're actually doing. Look at what they're doing and saying and work with that. Don't read in that Farage is secretly based. He's playing this game. You don't know that. In fact, it's highly unlikely.
What I mean, it's not what it's not entirely the fault of people that feel that way, because Farage and a lot of these, especially some of these other figures, they imply that that's what they're doing. They don't say it, and people read into that saying, "Well, he can't say it. He's implying it."
Well, why can't he say it? I mean,
why can't he say it?
That's the question. And
why doesn't he imply? How come he doesn't imply that he's pro Israel and say he's pro Palestinian? Right. Why doesn't he do that?
Exactly. Like, yeah. Well, why does he not why does he not just do dog whistles to Zionists and just tell you what you want to hear?
No, I mean, nothing about that. The fact that, yeah, I think this is part of this. Now, I've critically supported Steve Bannon on some things, but part of the reason Salvini is saying shit like Judeo-Christian.
It could very well be Bannon.
Bannon.
Yeah.
And the League, just for some history here, the League actually was one of the first European nationalist parties that realized during the 90s that if you praise Israel and you hang out with Jews, suddenly the media stops attacking you as harshly. Suddenly you get access to good press. They still get attacked, but they get more access to better publicity, and the blows from the Judeo left, from the media, and from America, frankly, are blunt.
To soften.
So they figured this out, and they rode that to power. And a lot of parties in Europe, a lot of populist parties in Europe, copied their model. So the League actually invented that strategy to a large extent. The problem is, though, is that, you know, the issue here is that I'm not saying that it's a bad – that they're doing bad things all around. What I'm saying is that the sign a populist is about to sell you out is when he starts singing and dancing for Jews in a stadium full of empty seats. Okay, that's a sign. I mean, why is it that Netanyahu calls Salvini a great friend of Israel? You know, he's basically cheating on his Guma. He's with his Guma on Trump, because he says that about Trump too.
Yeah.
So why is he saying that about Salvini? And at the same time, 5 years ago, when the Greek government arrested 12 Golden Dawn parliament members, Netanyahu went to Greece and praised them for doing that and thanked them for arresting Golden Dawn. So what is the distinction there?
Yeah.
What's the difference there? These are things that, like you said, you have to start putting them under the microscope when they start saying this stuff. Now, the Judeo-Christian thing, that's almost certainly a Steve Bannon imposition, because Steve Bannon last year opened up something called the Academy of the Judeo-Christian West.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
He opened that in Rome. That's literally what it's called, by the way.
Yeah, and his goal was to actually create this coalition of this axis of central powers, if you will. But no, his goal was to actually create this. He wanted to bring together people like Salvini and Orban and such like that. That was what he wanted to do. But in a way, that's kind of sinister, actually. Like, it seems like at first it's like, oh, wow, Steve Bannon based. But then it's like, well, wait, do we really want this guy doing that? You know, do we really want these people influenced by an American in that way? Like, I don't.
Yeah, think but so. that's why the League does this. It's because they realize that if you talk about Judeo-Christian values and you praise Israel and you give tax cuts to billionaires, suddenly you have American friends and benefactors. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where's the money for the Judeo-Christian Academy coming from? That's what I want to know. Like, who's paying for that? It's not Bannon.
Who the fuck is Bannon himself? Is I mean, he's got money, but he's not like super, super wealthy. So
how does he get an audience?
I don't think it's Robert Mercer leaders. Anymore either. I mean, maybe it is, but who knows? I mean, it would be something to look into.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who's paying for this. I don't know what they're teaching them in these things. These are basically like consulting services where they teach them basically how to operate discourse and how to govern and so on.
Well, there was an article in Wired. I don't know if you saw that article in Wired recently about Bannon's, it was about Bannon's trip to Europe and what he's doing over there, and how, and now of course they were framing it, is it surprise you that Europe has taken this sharp right turn suddenly? Well, Bannon's responsibility. That was the framing that they were using. Mm-hmm. But there was also some hidden little nuggets in there where they were saying, like, for example, the people from the Front National in France didn't really like Bannon, and they were like, this guy's kind of full of shit. Like, that was at least according to that article, you know, it's, there's reasons to be kind of press X to doubt on some things in there, but it's an interesting piece. And also, what? You know, it shows the agenda of the author gets in the way of actually getting to the bottom of it. But yeah,
let me say this about Front National, or they're now the National Rally. So in the European Parliament, Orban is not affiliated really with Salvini's with the League in mm-hmm. the European Parliament because of this disagreement on the Dublin Agreement. So really, the only friends the League has are Le Pen's people. They did very well in the French election, as they always do, actually. I mean, I believe the longest serving European Parliament member is Jean-Marie Le Pen. Mm-hmm. So they've always done very well in European elections, but they have no power in France. But one thing I will say is that the one exception to all these this populist wave is Front National. I mean, they were somewhat liberal during the Cold War on economic stuff, but they actually have a full nationalist, anti-banker, anti-globalist economic platform. It's very it's not bad. It's pretty good, actually. So they're the exception to the rule. So it is kind of interesting that they were the ones that were not too fond of what Bannon is peddling out there.
Yeah, I mean, I had noticed that as well, that I could see exactly why it was that they might not. And the way the author of the article described it was they thought that he was like his ideas were crude and like too American for them, which is in a way maybe that French snottiness came in handy there, because they weren't gonna go in that, and I probably more principled than that. But the point is that, you know, I mean, and Front National, and I know you say like, oh, one thing is they actually did dangerously for the elites. They did dangerously well in the last real election in France too.
Yeah.
So they, you know, I know people have criticisms of them, but I have found that I think that, you know, of all of these parties, I found them to be the one that I find the most intriguing.
Same here. Yeah. I those are the ones that are the least worse by far. But
I know there's Jews involved and such like that, but
yeah, but that's just how it goes.
I mean, yeah, but remember, we just told everyone not to settle for that's just how it goes. But
I'm not settling. I'm just saying that of all these groups, Front National is the least worst.
Start signaling Zionism and things like that, then I'll be.
The thing is, though, is that the difference is. So I'll tell you what the difference is. So Jews in France are pretty hostile to the Front National, because Jews in France are far more powerful than Jews in Italy are.
Right.
So because there's just a lot more of them. It's for the same reason Jews in America never went for Trump, even though he licks their ass all day long.
Yeah.
They don't feel that they have to work with
yeah, they don't, they didn't think they needed
Le Pen
Trump
because they don't need them. They control everything else, and the way the election system in France works makes it very difficult for National Rally to win very strong positions in the government. So Jews right now in France, their strategy is to just control every party but Le Pen's,
yeah,
and just block them.
Which is why they all did a, you know, which why they did, like, you know, you had every party forming a coalition against them in order to defeat them in the last election.
Exactly. In Italy, it's not so cut and dry, because Italy has very few Jews, and they're, you know, they have positions in power. I mean, they own La Stampa, they own various media entities, but the truth of the matter is that the Italian politics are quite anti-Zionist.
Yeah.
Just 3 years ago, there was a non-binding, of course. It's always non-binding when they do this. But the Italian parliament voted to recognize a Palestinian state in overwhelming numbers. And that includes some right-wing MPs. So clear, they don't have the same power. Like, the stakes are low for them in Italy, in their minds. So they they're willing to work with the Salvini and the league and people like that who actually move the Overton window in their direction.
Yeah.
You know, if it, European voters, like I said before, European voters left and right are either totally apathetic about Israel and don't want their country involved in Middle Eastern bullshit, or pro-Palestinian. There's there's literally no demographic of people of voters that are pro-Israel. There's no evangelicals in Italy.
Yeah, there's no Christian Zionists or the types like the boomers or anything like there's nothing like that in Europe.
That doesn't exist outside of America, frankly.
It's only in America, and that's a testament to just the absolute and complete and total control that Jews have here that they were able to cultivate. This population of
people. There's also a bit of that in France too, believe it or not. There is a believe it or not, a kind of far right anti or pro Zionist thing which made them upset. I think it was Eric Zemmour or one of these kikes over there. He was like an anti Islam intellectual, and he was upset because the yellow vests were throwing eggs at him. And of course, you know, here's a funny thing. When that happened, they were saying French Jewish intellectual assaulted.
I remember when that happened.
By eggs, but then when you throw eggs and milkshakes at people Jews don't like, that's it's just a milkshake, boy. It's just an egg.
When that soy reporter on Twitter was saying it's not an act of violence, it's a political tradition. I was like, okay, so I can throw a milkshake on a Jew then. I can go to England and throw milkshakes at Jews.
Yeah, at Zionist Jews. Because they're not saying they're throwing – they didn't throw them at a random Jew on the street. They found an intellectual, high-profile, neocon Zionist Jew. Yeah,
it was threw an egg at him. It's a political act. They didn't like his politics. So they hit him with food products. It's not violent.
And look at the reaction to that.
Oh, God. There was editorials in America about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was
the dark side of the yellow vest.
Yeah, yeah. No, that was what they were doing. And also around then is when – coverage totally ceased. Remember, like, coverage of the yellow vest in America is completely gone. There is none, zero. They simply don't talk about it. Dead radio silence. Yeah. They were covering it because there was some lurid images of violence and things like that, and burning and rioting and such that they could put on the front page and be like, "Ooh, look at that." But then they saw the political orientation of it, and then there was even attempts by Antifa and these revolutionary communist J left groups to try and co-opt or pretend to Americans that this was some workers Marxist style workers their phony thing. And it's, I mean, obviously it was workers uprising, but it was not in any way inspired by their ideals. And they've given that up too. They realized that it wasn't tenable. It was also causing infighting because when someone would think they were doing, you know, being clever and trying to co-opt yellow vests, some Jew in their circles would step in and be like, "They're anti-Semites."
Pardon me. It wasn't actually Zemmour. So here's the actual. I was just trying to get it off the top of my head. It was actually Alan Finkielkraut.
Yes, that's right. And, yeah.
Finkielkraut. Yeah, nice. And I actually don't think they even egged him. They just cornered him, and basically taunted him, and that was considered to be this big crime against humanity. So they didn't even throw anything at him, to my knowledge. That's the double standard right there. They called them here it is. Yellow vest scream, dirty Zionist at French writer.
Okay.
And that's Alan.
Now that is a political act. That is a act of politics. It's not a violence.
Mm-hmm. And look at the reaction.
Yeah.
Expressions of hatred on the rise.
Language is violence when it's the language that they don't like, when it's the language that they don't want to hear.
Yeah. Wow. And so the point I'm making here is that, you know,
they were even doing it in the UK. They were telling Sargon his language was violence. And then they were attacking him violently and saying it wasn't violent. I mean, but yeah, anyway, go on.
Yeah. So what I'll say here is that don't let low political self-esteem be a problem. You know, a lot of the times people cling to Salvini or Farage or Trump because they don't think that our ideas can stand on their own. But they absolutely can. In fact, the reason these men were in power or are in power is because
yes,
of our ideas. They riff off of our ideas, our grassroots movement, our people posting the memes, people on social media. A lot of the reason, too, another thing I wanted to bring up about the European election is that some of these groups like Golden Dawn and NPD, the reason they lost seats is because of the social media crackdown. It's made it impossible for dissidents to campaign.
Well, Golden Dawn, I mean, when you talk about election interference by Russia, it's a total fucking joke. But the reality of it is, if Golden Dawn, which is a party that's won seats of power in both the EU Parliament and in Greece, and they're just cut off, they're banned from all platforms. Well, now that's election interference, okay?
Or how about the fact that their members of parliament were in jail for 2 years?
Yeah, I mean that's election interference, but that's the state. That was the Greek state that did that. I'm talking about the social media companies that there's no Golden Dawn Facebook, there's no Golden Dawn Twitter. Those will get banned and have been banned if they ever existed. They might have.
No, they're totally banned, but this is new. This is in the last 2 years. It wasn't like this before.
Yeah.
It's in the last 2 years that they lost their Twitter accounts, they lost their Facebook accounts, their YouTube, I think, is still up.
And so if you're wondering,
policed,
you know, you could point out that the stuff about election interference in Russia is bullshit, and that's true. But also, what is the real agenda there? What are they using that as cover for? They're using that as cover to implement actual election interference, right? Like, so the we can't let Russia interfere in our elections is the excuse they're using to go to manipulate all of their algorithms and platforms to create the election outcomes that they want rather than the ones that they don't want. So they want to do election interference. It's just that they don't want, you know, they don't want parties like Golden Dawn inserting themselves into it. That's election. If Golden Dawn tried to post a tweet, that's election interference now, right? But them just banning a legitimate party that's won power before, that has won enough votes
that
for
isn't
power.
That has power, that is in the parliament. They did re-elect MEPs.
Yeah, they are represented in a political body. They should not be able to be banned from social media. Sargon, as a legitimate candidate for a legitimate registered party, had his UKIP account banned. So that affected it. Now, we talked about Sargon a lot because Americans are kind of plugged into that, so it's relevant. But it's another example. That's election interference. Sargon was smarter, he would have said so, but he didn't.
Well, the thing with that, you know, I don't want to talk about Sargon again, but they're going to lynch us. They're going to have a yellow vest uprising over this. But the truth about Sargon is that, you know, the reason he wasn't able to freely campaign, because on the one hand, he, like I said before, like, the man was under police investigation. His campaign was under investigation from the cops because he called a politician ugly.
Yeah,
that's essentially what he did. Yeah. He called that Labor politician ugly.
Yeah.
And that became what? A criminal investigation? Something that happened 2 or 3 years ago? He sent that tweet 3 years ago, I think.
4 years ago.
Yeah, 2 years ago. That is suddenly coming back.
It was four years ago. I want to be clear about this.
Okay, so that's suddenly coming back.
He's been banned from Twitter for 2 years.
Yeah, so that's coming back. And then you have, of course, the police looking on as anarchists commit acts of violence on him when he's going out there trying to campaign. How's that acceptable?
I mean, can one of Sargon's followers throw a milkshake on Jess Phillips?
No. They can't even tweet at her.
They will be put in jail so fast for doing that. And it would be, and the UK media, with absolutely no reference to what they said the day before, would call this person a violent hooligan and malcontent and somebody that needs to be dealt with. With absolutely no reference to what they said the day before. And it's not because they lack self-awareness. It's because they're just liars.
Because they're Jews.
Bags.
Yeah. It's because they're Jews and bugmen. So the point I'm making here is that the European elections were unremarkable because, frankly, the dissident parties were not able to freely campaign. Mm-hmm. But also the shortcomings of some of the right liberal populist parties. They have unpopular economic views. You know, if you're Nigel Farage and you support privatizing the National Health Service, that's an enormously unpopular
position. Hugely unpopular in England.
Okay, if you're in Italy, a place where the fucking oligarchs cheat on their taxes already, and you want to give them another fucking tax cut, that's really fucking unpopular. Okay, the solution to the tax problems in Italy is not to put the burden on working people. It's to fucking find tax cheats and shoot repeat offenders legally through a court system. That's the fucking solution. That's how Mussolini would have done it.
Yeah, they also should you know, they should never have given the power of their currency to another body. That's how the EU gets these countries by the balls. And even though I am for pan-European cooperation, these countries should have their own printing press. And that's a big problem that totally...
Their own currency.
You cuck yourself so badly. That is one of the main sources of the power of a state. And if you've given it over to a supranational financial body, we're talking about the power of finance over the state, nothing is a better representative of this than that these states have literally given over the power of their currency to a supranational financial body, the European Central Bank, that is not under any democratic control.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, to maybe put a conclusion to this topic, you know, you gotta have your radar on. Okay, when you see Salvini going out there invoking Judaism while he clutches a rosary, you gotta be asking, like, why the fuck is he doing that?
Yeah, it's weird.
Why is he doing that? It's like we were talking about last week, Mike. We were talking about how similar some of these figures are to the Ronald Reagan Revolution.
That's
right?
That is eerie. That's strange because
it's fucking
not...
eerie. They combine religious conservatism to a kind of, at least by European standards, more aggressive engagement with the Middle East on behalf of Israel, and tax cuts for the rich.
Yeah, that seems to be. I mean, if you think, I mean, thinking about it, it seems to be that this is a template that they worked out in the U.S. and they're exporting it. I mean, much how American liberalism, in terms of civic nationalism, they've tried to export that to Europe. Like, oh, being an American isn't about being white, and in fairness, that's an iffy proposition that it's the being an American is all about being white. I know some people have tried to meme that, but you know, that's another conversation. But right. They have exported that to Europe, where German and English and Sargon himself fell prey to this. He boxed himself in and he couldn't get his way out. We did a video on this. You could see it. Mm-hmm. It was on last Friday's TDS where I talked about this. And it's on,
right.
It's on YouTube if you want to check out my comments on his inability to cut himself out of that wet paper bag of an argument that he's trapped in. But, you know, he could just say, we're English and English people are of the white race, but we're still English. Yeah. That's the obvious argument. And he can't do that because whatever. But they have exported this idea of citizenship. Nationality is about citizenship, not about ethnicity and race. And so
with the United Kingdom, you could make that argument because of the Commonwealth. But how are they making that argument in Italy or Germany?
Yeah, it's
fucking baseless.
Yeah, I mean, even so, you can't make that about the word English, maybe British, but not English or Irish or Welsh.
No.
Those are specific. And the thing is, though, but that was sort of their first thing that they exported. Now they're exporting the American conservative model to Europe, which seemingly is stupid because it's not popular there. But it makes you think, well, you know, when they started doing that in America, it wasn't popular here either. I've said this before to people, like, look, Reaganism didn't have a big hold in America prior to, you know, the post-war era, and even really the Reagan era. You know, we talked about Ike before. Ike was a Republican. Ike was very different of a figure than Ronald Reagan. Despite, we know Ike's issues with the.
I don't like Dwight Eisenhower, but just like with Stalin, I can look at the man from an objective historical perspective.
And you know? and the difference between his style of government and the Reaganism, which is this libertarian Christian Zionism, you know, is with those sort of a mishmash of those things, that it's very odd to see that in Europe because it's not something that you would expect because they don't really like neoliberal or openly neoliberal, openly pro-business politics in Europe. It's not something that would win you would go out and say previously. Now they will. And they don't like Zionism. They don't want to be involved in that. And so if you have it's very odd for European politicians, particularly those invoking traditional values, to then also invoke big business in Israel. That's just odd. Like, it's something that has been in America, but it's actually odd here, too. It's just been here for 40 years.
The Trump tax cuts are hugely unpopular in America. So imagine in Italy. Where they already have a problem getting people to pay taxes, the rich people, because the poor people have to pay taxes. They don't have the money for the accountants or anything like that, or to put their money in Cayman Island bank accounts or Switzerland or whatever. But the oligarchs in Italy are going to get a nice fat tax cut here.
Yeah, you know, there's probably also some aspect of that that's about opening it up to foreign interest coming in as well, making a attractive environment. So
well, that's another problem with some of these parties. They're for privatization. So you know, some of these European countries, even though the EU has kind of stamped that out to a large extent, they still have national industries, like publicly owned companies and stuff.
And
these right populists, their big thing is, these are wasting our money.
They're taking and they
want to privatize them. But then the problem is that when the private companies that's what Margaret Thatcher did in England.
Yeah.
And the problem is that she privatized all the telecommunications companies. So lo and behold, 2008 comes around. All these companies collapse because they gambled on the wrong things. And the British government has to pay them to keep them alive. So you're paying private shareholders to keep these companies up because you need them for infrastructure purposes, but the state coffers don't get any money back. So that's what happens when you privatize companies, because you can't possibly have a country where the one of the two telephone companies collapses. You can't have that. Okay, so this is really just a scam. This is a scam. And so people that run on these platforms, it really makes me suspicious of them. You know, again, I'm probably my suspicions are increased after Trump, you know, because I was taken away by Trump in 2006.
We got
everyone.
I think everyone has to. I think the PTSD is a good way of putting this, post-Trump this derangement syndrome or something like that. I don't know. What is it?
Post-Trump stress disorder.
Yeah, post-Trump stress disorder, because it's basically, I don't know if it's a disorder, but it's basically like, look, I am now hyper-skeptical of this stuff, and I think that what we need to do is take a second look at the idea that we'll do a conservatism, we'll do a fascism, right? Like, because that seems to be sort of like, and I'm not saying I have like an alternative plan, definitely, and I if people are still arguing for strategic support of this or that, I get it, but look at it this way. I think the best way to frame it is this. These guys have to signal or imply or wink and nod and give someone a little elbow that they're going to do the racism. Or they're going to do the immigration control. Or, you know what I mean? Like, they do that. And sometimes they do more than just signal. I mean, Trump went out and said he's going to deport a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. I believe Salvini has said as much as well. I don't know. You know, you speak
all
Italian.
All the time. Yeah, all the time. And it's always implied. And he does do it to some extent. The new ones he deports. But I think already there.
We are big on immigration control. You know, there was that funny thing, and Jazz Hands did this bit on his show a couple of weeks ago, where there was this take, it was from a certain website, doesn't matter, where the guy was saying, you should support the Kushner immigration plan, because it'll allow you to red pill your normie neighbors with something. Now, just listen, let me finish. You've read the take, right?
Sorry.
So the argument is, support the Kushner immigration plan because it'll allow you to red pill your normie conservative neighbors on immigration control, because they'll be able to grasp onto something that is mainstream, the Kushner plan, that has some control. And from there, you can argue your way to further control and then maybe reducing immigration to zero. And I'm like, you don't need to red pill your normie con neighbor. He already wants to kick all the Mexicans out. Like, you don't need to... You don't need to red pill him on that. He would be like, if you go to your Normicon neighbor and you're like, the Kushner immigration plan says this, this, and this, and we're going to have this many foreign workers, and he'll be like, what the fuck? Why don't we just kick these people out? Now, not to say that guy won't go and vote Trump, but you know what I mean. You get what I'm saying.
The argument those people make is that racist and fascist and statist discourse turns the normies off. But if that was true,
why do these people signal to
Israel?
Yes.
Why do they support Israel then? Why, if that is the taboo, why do they support a country that literally ethnically cleanses and murders people and has a socialist economy? Why do they do that then?
Yeah, and that isn't, and that actually, you know, in Europe particularly, it's not very popular. And honestly, it's not even that popular in America.
No.
It's certainly, I mean, liberals, the funny thing is, there's a certain Stockholm syndrome on the left that maybe you don't get a glimpse into too often, but if you have liberal family members, you'll see it, or if you were ever once on the left, you'll see it, where they don't like Zionism in Israel. They do copes with that too.
Right.
They have to do that. Hillary doesn't really mean that. I've had family members say, well, she's not really about that, but, you know, these people have a lot of power and she's got to do what she's got to do, etc. We know. It's terrible.
Fascinating.
So that exists on the left, too. There are copes on the left like this as well, where they don't like it, but they know it's a lightning rod you can't touch. You know, it's the third rail, so to speak, that you can't touch it or you get zapped. And they also know that their politicians are going to cuck for it, and they cope.
Well, you know, in my case, people will – there's going to be that crowd of people who say, well, you're an Islamo-cuck, and you want them to support Hezbollah and shit, which is actually 100% true.
So you are in fact, an Islamo-cuck then. I just want to get that on record.
Yeah, well, you know what? So is Nick Griffin, Udo Voigt, Golden Dawn, and the other guys who met with Hezbollah last March as European emissaries. They met with them and declared that they supported their struggle against Zionism and Islamic terrorism. So, you know, that incidentally, doing stuff like that is actually like a kind of inverted signal that you're based.
Yeah, well, I would say this. I'm not going to adopt the Islamo-cuck label, but I generally agree with your position on this. In fact, I definitely agree with it. I just think that – and think about it like this. The alt-right didn't have problems being big Bashar Assad fans because he was fighting Zionism.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was fighting both ISIS and, you know, through that a proxy war against Zog, which was trying to destroy his country.
And America.
Yeah, the whole thing. And we didn't have a problem. Now, he's Muslim, so what is supporting him? Islamo-cucking? No, it's supporting the enemies of Zionism. And the point in the West, when you're talking about immigration, I don't want to see immigration arguments diverted into religious disputes that don't matter. Like, Christians can have a theological problem with Islam if they want. That, to me, doesn't matter because I don't want to get involved in that argument. That's a theological debate. I'm not interested in theology. I'm interested in immigration. And I think that when you set that bait for people that are interested in religion and disputes and things like that, and oh, the Prophet Muhammad fucked a 9-year-old girl. Arabs were fucking 9-year-old girls 1400 years ago. What do you want me to tell you? You know, like, fine. I'm not interested in that. This is a problem of demographics and immigration. And
this
if
is
you
a
reduce
problem
it
of
to
race.
If you reduce it to a religious problem, you're missing the mark. You're just missing the mark. Those people are going to be Muslim. If you hate Muslims, when you get them out of your country, there's still going to be an antagonism. I don't care about burqas. Right. I don't care about women's rights. I don't care about the mullahs in Iran. That's their country.
The point is that people will say that I'm an Islamo-cuck, but it's not really about, you know, I'm not saying Salvini necessarily has to go. I understand the issues or whatever, that he has to go and say, oh, I support the Hezbollah now. No, I understand that. What I am saying, though, is why is he so over the top, unusual by Italian standards, by European standards at large, so over the top in supporting Israel?
Yeah.
And why? So clearly he's talking to someone, and it's not his voters. That's what I'm saying. Who's he talking to? Yeah. Who's he talking to, and what does he get for talking that way, for taking the because he's doing bad optics by doing that, because the last thing European voters want is to get engulfed in Israel, dude, Palestine stuff.
They really don't want to be like involved Israel in that. In Europe.
They don't
they
want.
Really don't.
They don't want the Italian soldiers serving as peacekeepers in Lebanon to get dragged into the coming conflict. There is a conflict on the horizon between Israel and Hezbollah.
Oh yes.
And they don't want Italian soldiers to get blown up in that conflict. So why is he fucking sticking his fucking spoon into that?
Well, there's always, I mean, look, whatever the next conflict that Israel ignites is going to be, it's going to be, there's going to be one, right? And you don't, Italians don't need to be involved. And, you know, Spain has extricated themselves. You know, they pulled out of the coalition in Iraq, you know, when the socialist government won the election a decade ago. And they pulled out of the flotilla that, you know, they pulled out of the carrier group that the U.S. was sending over to that region. That's popular. People like that. People want them to do that. Whatever else you can say about the Spanish government, which is a lot, but like,
right. That's, and by the way, they also have their own libertarians.
Yes, I know you have a bug up your ass about Vox.
I fucking hate Vox. That's why. I can't believe in a country that has such a rich fascist history, this is what they fucking offer, and they get 10%.
Yeah.
They get the Republican Party light.
I have to defer to you on this because I just don't know much about Vox, but I'll take your word for it. I mean, it's
the same thing.
That you, yeah, it seems to be it's the same template. It does seem that this template is being now exported to Europe, and it's interesting because Europe is kind of facing. It's like Europe now is kind of like in terms of demographics and racial relations is kind of like U.S. in like the soon after, you know, the civil rights era, where like it's coming to grips with racial integration and things like that, right? Except they're getting it in like it's obviously not totally analogous, but there's parallels there. And you know, we were talking about 1994 and the crime bill, and you know, 1994 people still had not adjusted to the idea that there was parts of cities that were just overcome by black crime and were just hopeless. People are well adjusted to that now. That's just the norm. That wasn't people didn't consider that the norm in 90s. People were like, "What the hell?" Take back
the
streets. Take back the night. That was a thing in the 80s and 90s. I remember it when I was a kid. People were talking about that. Take back the streets. There was campaigns like that.
Look at the debate between Peter Brimelow and Julian Simon. That was in 1995, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Brimelow today can't even rent a conference hall in Colorado. He can't rent a hotel conference room for a fucking just to talk about the same things he was talking about on TV with prominent Jewish conservatives.
Yeah. Julian Simon is another thing with that, but we'll get to that in a minute.
That's fine. But the point is that look at how the discourse has changed as the situation worsens.
Yeah.
So the point I'm making is that, you know, these guys on some level, these right liberal populists on some level are given ground when they don't have to.
Yeah.
They don't have to do this. They maybe in Britain, you have to give some ground to an extent because it's the integration and multicultural project is more advanced there, but it's not advanced in Germany or in Italy. I mean, I've been to Germany. I've been to Germany and you know the people that immigrated there in the 1980s, some of them came in the 60s. They're not integrated into German society. They're not.
Right. They're
Turks in Germany are still living in a parallel world. I mean, to be fair, the Turks in Germany are more are far less alien than the new ones coming in by far, and they're a lot less violent even than some of these Afghans.
Well, they weren't causing. I mean, I understand if you're German, you didn't want them there, sure, but
yes.
They were not. They did. There was not a high impact traumatic thing for the German nation. They're coming in, and because they stayed, in fact, this is where the anti-Islam critiques would actually break down, because wasn't it better for Turks to live in their parallel Turkish society as Muslims with their own rules and norms than for, you know, SJW busybodies to go and try and mix everybody together? Isn't that better?
Well,
I
disagree that the Turkish immigration wasn't traumatic. It absolutely was. But what's changed now is that the new migrants, the black ones and the Afghans and so on, those guys are so fucking savage that the Turks are now going to Pegida rallies, joining with the Germans, saying, don't bring these people into my community.
Yeah.
So like what's changed isn't so much it's that the threshold for what they tolerate. So the Turks are pretty violent and rambunctious and even lazy compared to the Germans. Right. That's a very high standard, though.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of tension there, and there was actually a huge explosion in the Nazi movement in the 80s over this. However, because of how things have worsened, the Turks have – I mean the Germans have kind of forgotten about the Turks and kind of, you know, just – you know, they don't care about that as much anymore because the new problems are much, much worse. So that's really what's changed, Mike. The Germans are like, whoa, we didn't like the Turks. Holy shit, look at these guys. They're fucking just coming up to you and groping you.
Yeah, no, it's like literal savages. I mean, at least the Turks could sell kebabs. But But they'll also use that as like then conservatives will be like, why can't we just have more people like the Turks and less like this? And you never get what you want. But I think the overall point here is to start analyzing politics in the way that we're talking about here, which is like, and I've learned this too, like, but I'm by no means innocent in any of this. I was taken in by Farage. I was taken in by Trump. I've been taken in by these campaigns. It feels like we're on the cusp of power. It feels, but in fact, we have a lot of work to do, a huge task ahead of us. But also, don't be demoralized because your politics aren't popular. They are, which is why they need release valves. The fact that they have a release valve is a signal to you that your politics are popular. The question is, how do we get out in front of the release valve? How do we make it release the other way? You know what I mean? Like that's the task that we have. It's not that it's not now. There's always going to be shit libs. There's always going to be leftists that hate us, whatever. They're going to make up a certain percentage of the population and whatever. That's not a battle that we're unprepared for, though. We're totally able and willing and eager to take those people on. The issue is we can't keep getting cucked like this by people that are acting as a release valve, and then they turn around and they do they give over a bunch of stuff to Zionists and international capitalists and give us nothing. You know, so that's what we gotta not allow anymore. And we can't think that our politics aren't popular. Trump talked about deporting everybody, and he winked and nodded that it was going to be Mexicans and not whites. Salvini talks about getting blacks out of Italy. Politicians have risen to power on the promise of essentially racially purifying a nation. Okay,
Brexit was the
wink and
Brexit
nod
was seen as a referendum on immigration.
I mean, when I showed that article about Farage saying that to people, there were people that were thunderstruck. They were like, "I thought this was about immigration. I thought this was about not wanting immigrants being forced on Britain by the EU." And I was like, "Well, a lot
That's
of people thought that."
Too.
And when Farage wanted to win that election, you better believe he encouraged people to believe that. He winked and nodded and gave people an elbow and signaled to you that that's what that was about. When he wanted to win that vote, he absolutely signaled that way.
Yeah. So the point I'm making here is
– It would not have won.
I've come up with three red
flags. If Brexit was about polls out, blacks in, it wouldn't have won.
No. So yeah, I mean, especially now with the amazing amounts of knife crime. I mean, why does a city like Manchester, London, have the same knife crime as some of the worst parts of America? Like, why is that happening in Europe?
Dude, you know the ads in America about like, dude, they have stop the violence and stuff. I don't know. America is actually so cynical. They used to do this in the 80s and like gun buyback. They have like knife buybacks. You know, they have, like, gun buybacks at police departments in America to get guns off the streets, like, no questions asked. But they do that with knives in Britain. And they have, like, ads in the tube, as they call it there, to, like, don't carry a knife. It could be in the rest of your life. And it's like, what? What?
You know, back to how right-wingers sell us out. But back to how right-wingers sell us out, the knife crime is 100% on Theresa May. Because she was the Tory home office person, and she made budget cuts to the police. So hear me out here. I did a lot of research on this too. So Theresa May resigned last week, you know, an absolute disgrace. But you know, her entire political career has been one disaster after another. That's why Peter Hitchens says, you know, Who would look at this woman and say she ought to be prime minister of an industrial superpower? Who thought that? And, you know, so Theresa May in 2015, I believe, cut funding for the police by 20% in the big cities. The police protested and they said, we can't do our jobs now. And you know what her response was? Her response was to call them racist. She said, well, you know what the real problem is? You can do more with less by creating better ties with the black community who simply don't trust you because of your racial profiling of them. That was her response. Now, 3 years later, on her watch as prime minister, they have the knife crime rate of Detroit.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know if that's exactly true, but maybe Newark. I don't know. It's pretty
high. Whatever
it
might be, it's unprecedented. Matter. It's very high. I mean, the thing I've always said about New York, weirdly, is that the crime is relatively low given the demographics and the diversity and what's going on. That's because New York is Jew-owned territory. So Mike Bloomberg, who's a big liberal Jew, is more than happy to crack down on crime because that's his city. But
even de Blasio, de Blasio signals a lot about SJW stuff, but you know de Blasio's police are still fucking hard asses.
Yeah, I mean, and they the stuff that they were doing early got pushback from wealthy Jews in the Upper West Side and places like that who didn't actually want homeless blacks pissing on the sidewalks. So all that kind of stuff, they had to dial that back. They still don't do the stop and frisk, but they made a huge thing about that. So
yeah, but what they do instead is stop and ask questions. So it's just a technicality. The sheer truth and the blunt truth is that the NYPD is the size of a military.
It's a small. It's an army. It's the size of not a small army, a large army.
It's a military that is surveilling. There's cam. If you go in Manhattan and to most
they
places, they have cameras everywhere.
They have branches like a traditional military. They have like their counterterrorism and intelligence branch, and they also work with Israel. So just so everyone understands, like,
yeah,
there's all kinds of, I mean, it's like they're almost just a branch of the Israeli fucking IDF.
Well, you know, that's if you look at the crime rate in New York City compared to very much whiter and even wealthier and less black areas like a place like Portland, like Minneapolis, like San Francisco. Those places have far higher crime than New York City, and it's because they don't have an army.
Well, that's the thing. I mean,
the funding for the New York Police Department is in the billions.
Yeah, there's larger than 40,000
militaries for countries around the world.
40,000 uniformed officers, and that's not the meter maids. That's cops.
Exactly.
That's not the Pakistani Jews, guy you see giving the tickets on the cars. You know what I'm talking about, or the Filipino.
Right. So Jews may be woke with you. But when it comes to their families, they're very,
comes
very
to their
serious.
Own turf. Look, you can – I mean, people think – it's funny because I've had people come and they assume New York is a dangerous place. I'm like, sure. You go out to the Bronx. You go out to the Brooklyn. You go out to the fringes and the ghettos and stuff. Yeah, there's danger there and there's terrible crimes committed there. You walk in Jew territory, the middle of Manhattan, safe, middle of the night, all by yourself, totally safe.
Even the Bronx and Brooklyn now with
depends on where you are. There are very bad.
Even then,
parts,
it's nothing like it was 20 years ago.
It's nothing
not even close.
Or in the 70s and 80s, like when crime was under David Dinkins, because they put a black in. The typical thing happens. But the funny thing is, so my point here, though, is that crime isn't a puzzle on how you solve it. It's not a big. I mean, you have the elite, the intellectuals in America would have you believe that there's some big dilemma, there's some big issue that they need to sit down and do TED Talks and write papers and have conferences and explore what to do about it. It's not. They know what to do. You know how to solve crime. You punish criminals. Hard.
Right.
That's it.
That's what Jews know for a fact.
And they know that themselves.
My theory, so a lot of people say, oh, why didn't the Jews make a bigger deal out of the Crown Heights riots in the 90s?
Huh.
Well, they did make a big deal. They didn't get mad at blacks. They got even. So after the Crown Heights riots, Jews got their act together. They got Giuliani in charge. And Giuliani basically was policing blacks in a way that hasn't happened since the Jim Crow era. Okay? Yeah. Any black guy walking in the street after dark in Crown Heights would get stopped by the cops, frisked. And that's if it's the NYPD and not the vigilante cops. They have the shamrim. Those are the Jews. They dress like cops. So you have private groups of Jewish vigilantes that impersonate the police. They have cars that look exactly like the NYPD cars.
And they wear
uniforms. They have all that shit. And if they see a brother walking around trying to flirt with a Jewish girl or going into a Jewish shop and maybe looking like they're about to, you know, even if they just walk into a Jewish shop, the Shomrim shows up and like, yo, what are you doing here? You don't belong here. This isn't your fucking neighborhood. Go back to your side of the
tracks. They have an apartheid, a Jewish apartheid police in Queens and Brooklyn. And dude, you remember, I don't know if you ever saw that movie Defamation. Do you remember that movie? It was actually a good movie. A Jew did it.
Watch court dramas.
It's not a court drama.
Isn't that the one about the David Irving case?
No, that might also be called Defamation. This one's a documentary about the ADL. It was actually done by a Jew, and it's funny as fuck. You should watch it. It's done by a Jew, but he's doing kind of a David Cole Stein thing where he's like, Jews are too paranoid. It's making everyone hate us, blah, blah, blah. But he does this bit where he goes to these Jews standing on a corner outside this housing project, I think in Brooklyn somewhere. And he talks to them. They're all woke on the protocols, Elders of Zion. You know, blacks love their conspiracy theories and such. And they even talk about how the Jews game the welfare system. It's pretty funny. They're like, we go to the welfare office. You know, they all go to the welfare office. Like, we go to the welfare office. You know, Jews are there 6 a.m. They're like, the Orthodox Jews are there first thing in the morning, lined up first in line to get service at the welfare office. Or the Social Security officer, wherever they go to get their payments. And then the guy asked him, he's like, well, do you guys rob Jews a lot? Cause they talk about going out and robbing each other. They're like, oh shit, no. You rob a Jew, forget about it. They're like, the city will be down here in no time. They're like, the whole city comes down on you. And he's like, first of all, the thing they say is funny. They're like, first of all, they don't carry money on them. So, and they're talking about the Orthodox. They're talking about the Jews and the funny hats and the suits and such. Like, they don't carry money. But if you touch one of them, forget about it. They're like, the cops will be down here so fast. So they're like, so we just rob other people. But
yeah, and you know, when
but
it comes
it's amazing
to, when it,
how aware they are, that blacks are of this. Of that,
yeah,
these people,
you know,
are untouchable.
You know, in the NYPD's case, like the racial profiling, stop and frisk, these were obvious. These were policies that they imposed. They weren't implied. They were policies. They probably learned those policies in Israel. Frankly, they probably taught them to the NYPD.
Well, America had a good history of this kind of thing that they could tap into as well. But it was supposed to be.
I'm sorry, man.
That in the 80s and 90s anymore.
If the police were to do that in Pittsburgh, that would have been challenged in the courts.
Of course. Oh,
much
no, dude,
earlier.
I'm not disagreeing with you. My point
much
is
earlier.
That they don't really – to get an understanding of how to deal with that issue, you don't need to go far afield from America. You can't do it anymore. You can only do it in that part of the country. You know, you see what I mean?
Ironically, the bluest of the blue – you can do it there, and you know, now they've loosened it up a little bit, but that's only because all the blacks are in jail now.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, that's the
broken
other thing.
Windows
people,
policing did its job. The blacks now are either in jail or fleeing New York City. So the Jews got the last laugh there. The blacks in New York may have done the first ever pogrom, and probably the last one, at least for them, in American history, was done in the Crown Heights riots. They rose up against the Jews for murdering that little girl. But they got punished severely. They were driven out of their areas.
Oh, dude, where do you think gentrification started soon after?
Yep.
That area is being gentrified now.
Yeah.
It's still very black. I mean, look, there's still – the further out – the thing about New York is the further out from the middle of the city, which is the rich part, Manhattan, you get like the blacker and darker and browner it will get. You'll see them walking on the streets in Manhattan, that's because they all work, you know, day laboring job. They all work as cashiers and whatever. But they do. That's my – the point is you would look at the demographics of New York City. It's like only a third white and a good amount of what they classify as white is Jewish. Not very many white people there at all. You look at those demographics and you think, wow, it must be terrible crime here. But no, because they understand – how to deal with the issue of crime. So what I was saying is they pretend that this is a big issue that, oh, we don't understand. They also pretend they don't understand why crime dropped mm-hmm. in the 90s. Because they're like, there was this precipitous drop-off of crime, and we don't know why. And that book, Freakonomics, that came out, which was like kind of libertarian propaganda. But they were talking about this, and they're like, there's some big mystery. We don't know what it is. I'm like, you were putting a lot of black people in jail, is what happened.
The theory that Giuliani and the NYPD came up with is called the broken windows theory. So the philosophy behind that is that if you harshly police petty crimes like jumping the subway turnstile or smoking pot in public, then you can actually discourage bigger crimes. The reality of the matter is that, no, you're just putting black people in jail.
Well, I mean, the effect there is the same, though. They take people that are doing delinquent things as youths, putting them in jail for, like, harsh sentences for small... I mean, harsh sentences for small crimes will have the effect of reducing larger crimes, whatever the ultimate mechanism is, whether you're actually just sending the message or whether you're just taking the people that can't get that message and just putting them in jail. I think with blacks, it's mostly the latter. With white people, it would work as the former because white people will get the message. Like, the recidiv... And you see this from recidivism rates of criminals. Like, whites don't repeat offend nearly at the rate that blacks do. But... the point is, it's not a mystery how to deal with crime, right? Like, it's not a thing that we need to have conferences about. It's not a thing that we need to have, you know, Jewish scholars flying back and forth across the country and meeting with city governments and taking big subsidies and payoffs and having dinners out. And so we don't need to do that, having TED Talks about it and hand-wringing. No, we know what to do.
You just do, to quote Agnostic Front, New York police state. That's what it was. They fucking turned New York into a police state, and it worked.
It was a fascist policing policy.
I mean, you know what's funny? Again, as we always say, the left is usually right for the wrong reasons. Because that's the left's critique, is that this is a racist and fascist policing policy that the Giuliani administration created and has, you know, been preserved, frankly.
It made New York much more livable than it was in the 70s and the 80s.
Right. It turned New York into a police state, though. And they're totally right about that. You know, the left is right about that. Now, they say that's a bad thing. But, you know, it is what it is. Now you have the woker conservatives now, including Trump, counter-signaling that. Right. Yeah. But that's not going to affect a place like New York. That's going to affect people that, you know, places like the South, you know, that. They're under a lot of scrutiny. The Southern police departments are always under the microscope for, you know, historic reasons, they say. And that's going to affect them. You know, it's going to make those places worse because these things never affect the Jews. So, you know, long story short, you know, they know the causes and they know the effects. Okay. They already know that. And some of these populists know that too, which is why when they, like we said last week, when you're against mass immigration and globalization, but then you're for the entities that are causing it, big think.
I mean, and you just got to start looking at it like that. Like, why if this guy is talking about, you know, ending immigration, is he not talking about, you know, labor, is not talking about Zionism and things like that? Like, you know, it's like, why are the economic policies contradictory to the kind of policy that should follow along with an anti-immigration policy? Now, in Trump's case, he was actually signaling nationalist economics as well.
He was more radical in these Euro populists,
which was actually kind of crazy if you think about it. The package he was offering was not the complete package, but it was a pretty damn good one. It was a very tempting little piece of candy that he was dangling out there for us. And, you know, we bid on it, and that's fine. No one should feel embarrassed or recrimination or feel like you need to fight with somebody or even somebody that didn't get woke to Trump as fast as you did. They hung on. It doesn't matter. We have to get it now, and it shouldn't be a point of contention now. The point is we all see what happened, and we got to be aware that it doesn't happen again. And as that stops working, they're going to have to shift to different tactics. They're going to have to adjust, and we have to wake the public up to this thing that, look, you're getting taken for a ride. I know you love the idea of the wall and deporting Mexicans. Dude, Republicans are so woke on that. If you want to see bad optics, Go to and look. Also, I hesitate to call a lot of the sort of the blue collar working class red hat MAGA people conservatives, because some of them switch over from Democrats, but also like they're not motivated by ideological conservatism of like the William F. Buckley sort in any way.
No,
they were responding to the immigration, and the J left was once again right about this. And then the J right tried to make these people aren't racist. This is about this and that. And that there was this meme like, oh, it's economic distress. It's not racism. Well, the fact is that those two things are kind of tied together, right? The economic insecurity and the desire to see Mexicans deported are not radically separate the way they wanted to make them. Like those two things go together quite well. It makes sense that you are economically insecure and you see low skilled labor coming in and taking all the jobs and driving down wages. Like people understand this. And so you want to see bad optics. You want to see even, borderline Fed posting. Show a normie conservative a picture of one of the migrant caravans on the way to the border.
Right.
You will see Fed posting that would make me blush, and I'll be like, guy, you dial it back, all right? Like, relax. So it's not that that stuff is unpopular. It's very popular. And that's the thing we have to remember. Our policies are popular. They have to be defused and funneled off into release valves and taken care of that way. It's not because people don't want them.
So let me give you the three red flags for that a populist is about to sell you out. These are the three I've come up with. Number one, using that ridiculous word, Judeo-Christian values, that term. That in Italy, Judeo-Christian values is a post-war invention. It's made up. It's like saying Islamo-Christian values or anything like that. In fact,
Judeo-Islamo values. Imagine.
Yeah. So Judeo-Christian values is a post-war imposition on, you know, the fact that AFD and Salvini use that term. You know, both of their countries had Judeo-Christian, the Judeo-Christian philosophy, as they would call it, those values of liberalism and so on. Those were imposed on those countries through violence. The Italians and the Germans rejected these Judeo whatever values. So that's the first thing. When they use that term,
let's call them Judeo values.
Exactly. That's the first red flag. Second red flag: an aggressive and unprecedented posture and pivot towards supporting Israel. Big red flag. Again, it's not the policy itself that's the end of the world. It's just a red flag.
Yeah.
Of motives. Third, and this is more subtle, preaching American-style economics. No precedent in Europe. Okay, the social democratic state in Europe came after the Second World War because the European powers learned their lesson from the Nazis and the fascists, who, like Joseph Goebbels says, to reiterate that, the only way to stop radical movements is to control capital, because the abuses of capital breed radical both communists and Nazis.
So you actually could possibly find a president, but you had to go back to like the 18th century. But even then, it was like it was just what they did. They didn't tell people that. They didn't ask for approval for it.
That's what happened in Great Britain. You know, yeah. Winston Churchill, who was a liberal,
they were hugely libertarian back in the day. Like,
yeah, Winston Churchill was a liberal, and he lost the election during World War II in 1945.
That's something that people don't know. A lot of people
Clement
don't
Attlee,
know that.
Yeah. who ran on a socialist platform, Clement Attlee was the one that put in the National Health Service, council housing, so on and so on.
He also started inviting Commonwealth immigration, and then Churchill won again after that because people were reacting to the immigration. But that's but it was a kosher sandwich. But
it's a hot potato. Yeah. So those are the three red flags. If you see that they start pivoting towards that kind of nonsense, tax cuts for billionaires, Israel, and Judeo-Christian discourse, you got to start suspecting these people. And you know what? They're all doing it. They're all doing it.
Which means there's a plan, which means there's an organized thing going on. And it means that they have gauged the threat of populism. They've been talking about it in their press long enough. They knew that the immigration was destabilizing and causing this reaction. And this is part of a plan to deal with it. And you can even catch glimpses of this if you start looking at what they're saying and not just in their external political pronouncements, but like look at some of their Twitter accounts and such. Look, I was telling people when they were still trying to tell me Brexit Party was great and Farage was awesome, just go look at their Twitter. It's Charlie Kirk tier bullshit. It's gay as fuck.
Right. And again, to reiterate once more, the immigration has stopped because the German government and the French governments, both of them run by liberals, have turned the spigot off. They are paying. They're doing what they used to. I mean, why do you think there isn't as much immigration during the times when Gaddafi was in power? It's because they were paying Gaddafi to restrain the immigration. Now they're doing that again with other governments. And they're actually, if I looked at the figures correctly, it's in the billions of dollars. But I think they're paying more people more money to stop the immigration from Eritrea, Sudan, places like that. And that's, you know, what's funny too is that the Jewish human rights groups that are always whining about that are surprisingly kind of quiet or muted now, or maybe they're not being amplified because the dictator that runs Sudan is like this crazy genocidal black dude that is like and Macron and Merkel's governments are paying him. So even though the political careers of Macron and Merkel are over, they still have a vested interest in protecting the broader conspiracy, and they're pulling back. They're pulling back for now. For now.
For now. It's strategic. It's not principled. But yeah, and also, you know, and as far as Gaddafi, that goes to show you the wages of Zionism. You know, when you support Zionism, Gaddafi was, you know, you could think what you want about him, but he was a bulwark against exactly this migration problem that they're having. And he was willing to play that role. And Gaddafi was willing to play ball with the West. All you had to do was give the guy money. I mean, who cares? Like, isn't just giving some of these guys money better than all these constant conflicts and troops dying and civil wars and suicide bombings and terrorism and crazy jihadist Muslims running around? Isn't that better just to give a dictator some cash? Isn't that a better way to handle it? But Zionism was like, no, we don't like that because Gaddafi is a strong state close to Israel, and we don't like strong Arab states close to Israel. So
remember,
we would rather have open air slave markets in the country reduced to like pre-medieval, you know, for the Arab world time than you know, a strong secular socialist state that could be some kind of threat at some point to Israel.
The highest living standards in Africa were in Libya under Gaddafi.
I mean, it was a small population and a ton of oil.
Again, remember, the one and only reason why Gaddafi was deposed was because the Hillary Clinton State Department and the Sarkozy government, on the orders of Bernard Henry Levy, basically provided an air force to help the Al Qaeda people overthrow Gaddafi.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for that, they would be trapped and isolated like they are in Sudan. They have an uprising in Sudan, and no one's sending them air support to depose a government because the liberals have a strategic goal in keeping that guy in power for now.
Yeah,
and because they don't want more immigration to Europe because it's one thing to have your political career ruined. It's another thing for a massive nationalist backlash that ends up with you in the gallows. Very different. And on top of that, also may threaten the actual interests you serve. Remember, these people like Merkel and Macron, they serve financial interests. Macron, his background is in a Rothschild's bank. Okay. Merkel is more murky, but she is probably going to retire to some position like that too. So these people have a vested interest in protecting the broader conspiracy of the people that hired them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and, you know, the real scandal there was not – I mean, Benghazi, yeah, it was tragic what happened to the ambassador and the soldiers at the embassy and such. I agree. But that scandal went much deeper than simply Hillary Clinton forgetting to send the Marine helicopter. Okay? Like, it was much deeper than that. And it was much more scandalous and much more evil than that. Yeah.
In a sense, the Benghazi thing, the way that the GOP handled it was a kind of red herring. Why weren't
it was
talking?
Totally fucking fake, dude. And
it was
and it was exactly. And this is the thing. You got to watch out for Trey Gowdy's. Even on the red herring, he didn't wasn't willing to follow through. Trey Gowdy, just like Ted Cruz did with his hearing on free speech, and just like Lindsey Graham did at the Kavanaugh hearings, and everyone was saying he was so base. And look, I liked it too. I thought it was hilarious too. But you can't fall for these people are, despite the fact they seem goofy sometimes, they can be very effective actors. Think about it. Like, Trey Gowdy is a weird homosexual faggot-looking guy, as is Lindsey Graham. But hey, when they're effective actors, you'd be surprised how good they are at it. And Trey Gowdy got up there, and he constantly berated Hillary Clinton, and he berated Democrats, and he called for investigations and this and that. Right, but then as soon as it looked like...
Because you were hiding your emails on your
laptop. As soon as it looked like action might have to be taken on that, what does Trey Gowdy do? Well, he doesn't run again. Like, the guy's a showman. He's giving you a show. And that's and what Hillary, Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham that thing, do. And that's what Trump
does. The documents, I believe it was in WikiLeaks that came out, show that the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi was basically trafficking arms to terrorists from Libya Syria. And you know what I think? I think that they were probably killed by Iranian agents or Syrian agents, because I don't think it was just some random thing about some documentary. That was just the straw man.
Yeah, they were so mad about some anti-Islam thing or something. I had forgotten about that narrative, actually, that they were so mad about some anti-Islam I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, that was the narrative that they just happened to be there with no explanation, and they were killed by random mobs of people and so on. I don't buy it, because you know they were doing some seedy stuff out there.
I don't doubt that these people enlist fanatics in their agendas. I mean, you know, they clearly do enlist fanatics, but you know,
possible.
There was obviously more stuff going on than just that, though.
Yeah, that's
U.S.
not even
government.
Like, why isn't there a House hearing on why American operatives are smuggling Libyan arms from their armory to ISIS and Al Qaeda in Syria? Like, why isn't that a fucking House hearing?
Because,
you know, 30 years ago, say what you want about Jimmy Carter and some of these people in the past. 30 or 40 years ago, there might have been a House hearing on that very issue. There was a church committee.
Ramsey Clark,
like that.
I mean, he's got some stupid other kinds of politics, you know, but he was, you know, Jimmy Carter's attorney general. He made a career out of calling this shit out after he was out of office, of course.
Exactly. So the point I'm making is this is how far we've fallen in terms of the sheer relevancy of
Zionists
the state.
Hate Jimmy Carter, by the way. They fucking don't like that guy. But Zionists, they do not like Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter was inept in many ways, and he was shitty in many ways.
He wasn't a bad person, though. I never got that
impression. No, he was a pretty straightforward guy, which is why Reagan and Bush had him fucking, you know, that was also an intelligence operation. It's been proven as well that the Iran hostage situation was a fucking total, it was a total show. That's why they released them as soon as Ronald Reagan got into power.
Yep.
Okay. So anyway, you know, that's all besides the point. The point I'm making is that, you know, the goal we need to have is we can support populists. We can't be isolating ourselves from what's happening outside, from what's going on, you know, the happenings. With that said, we also need to focus 90% of our resources on our own political vehicles that actually will do things that we want.
We have to keep engaging because there are people that are going to continue to see. Like, there's a lot of people that love Nigel Farage, and I don't blame you. Sometimes the arguments over Trump got really nasty, where people that like Trump because of his personality, and which, you know, now I can't stand it, but that's just because he's such a con man. But I'm not going to lie. I used to like it. I used to think he was hilarious. And I used to have, even when I realized he was cucking, I had a soft spot for him. Now I think he's just a piece of shit. But it takes people a little while to get there. So I get it if you like Farage. I like Farage. I think he's fucking hilarious.
Farage.
But
he's actually really articulate, and watching him, you know, watching him humiliate these like Brussels liberals and stuff, like, it's just a fucking marvel. It's a
great
feast.
I mean,
your eyes and ears. But with that
only
said,
we had millions of dollars to hire him for our team. But,
exactly.
But without
either the cultural or financial power to get Nigel Farage to lobby for you,
Yeah.
You know, all that stuff is really just it's a car salesman. What do you want me to tell you?
You can like him and think he's funny, and I'm not. I don't want to add this to get nasty or personal with people because sometimes it has done that in the past, and that's just dumb. Just understand the point that we're making, and understand that. Look, don't trust the guy. All right, and engage with his fan base, and be like, look, I get that you like Farage, but don't you like, you know, cutting off immigration more? You know, aren't we actually here for some of these policies? Like, you wouldn't like Farage if he wasn't signaling that he was going to cut off immigration or wasn't pretending that. Like, you wouldn't like him if he was openly, you know, talking all this leftist anti-white SJW shit. Then you'd see him as an evil person. So his personality can't be the end all and be all of it. Like, that we have to demand these results and we have to see these red flags and call them out and make them not effective. Make it so that this type of politics that they're doing, these types of release valve politics, aren't going to work anymore. We can't let that work anymore. We can't get, as George W. Bush said, you can't get fooled again.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the problem is too is the assumption that because someone is quote right wing that they're going to push things in your direction, you know, isn't always true. I mean, Theresa May, look at the Tories. The Tories got a lot of votes, and Theresa May got put into power, and Theresa May's government was a disaster. Disaster.
So you want to hear something? You actually brought this up. The most, one of the worst, and think Theresa May is not a popular figure, so dragging her is not something that is unpopular. No one's gonna go to bat for Theresa May, but we'll do it anyway.
It's quite remarkable.
I mean, we'll attack her anyway. But like the thing you said, I didn't know about this, that there was a law passed that lowered in, I think it was 2001, and she was in the parliament at the time, lowered the age of consent for gay sex to 16. Which she voted against, and she, as prime minister, had to apologize to gay groups for that?
Yep.
Why do you have to apologize for that?
It was in the late 90s, early 2000s, sometime around there.
It was 2001, I looked it up.
She voted against such a proposition.
Yeah. I looked this up yesterday. It was 2001.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Milo says, gays love 16-year-old boys.
Well, he's not wrong.
Pedophile. Well, that's the British law, friend. What the fuck? Why?
I know. It was funny. It's like that. That's also how you know that, like, that's not why they killed Milo's career.
Right.
I mean, it was one thing that was why the alt-right all of a sudden was like, look, we can't even use this guy as a vehicle anymore because we don't want to be associated with this, understandably so. But that's not why the mainstream stopped associating with him. The mainstream promotes things that are far more disgusting than even that. Far more disgusting.
If you at some point back in the 90s, when again, the state was more powerful than capital, you were expected to represent your constituency and vote against this crap. Now the power structure has changed even more in the favor of capital and finance. These people have to go out and apologize to big fag, to big gay, big queer, and say, oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Gay CEOs I once almost tried to stop you from molesting 16-year-old boys. Here's another thing about Theresa May. You know, she gave that very famous, tearful speech when she resigned on Downing Street. And one thing that really caught my attention about it was that she quoted a figure in that speech, right? And again, this goes back to the initial thesis of this very episode of Strike and Mike, which is finance is stronger than the state. She quoted a figure. It wasn't Sir Isaac Newton. It wasn't even the Beatles. It wasn't a British figure. She's a British prime minister, and she's not quoting a British hero. She's quoting Sir Nicholas Winton, who is actually a Jewish international stockbroker during the 1920s and 30s, who, lo and behold, talk about kosher sandwich and one, the kosher pastrami. The man was not just an international finance capitalist. He was also part of a Marxist circle that was lobbying the British government in the 1930s to start a war with Germany. So this man, Nicholas Winton, was a Jew, obviously, and He is famous for the Kinder Transport. Are you familiar with that? The Kinder Transport?
No.
So the claims are that when Hitler entered the Sudetenland in 1939, Nicholas Winton personally intervened to save or to transport 300 or 400 Jewish children out of Eastern Europe to Britain. So they made this whole myth around him about that.
Yeah. Okay. And yeah, I've heard of this. Yes.
Yeah. The Kinder Transport. So anyway, this guy, you know, maybe it's nice. You know, you're saving children from a war zone,
well, even though the war wasn't even that brutal. Typical.
Of course, he was primarily saving Jewish children, right?
Yeah.
All the millions of white children that perished in the fucking fire and brimstone, this emissary of hell, fucking brought to earth. All those children, well, they can go. Who's even asking, schmuck, right? But when it comes to the Kinder,
it's funny how no one has the balls to point this out whenever Jews brag about this kind of stuff.
So you saved 300 Jewish children from a war you fucking wanted to start.
Yeah.
How about that?
Heroic.
You fucking lobbied. You worked day and night, spent untold amounts of money, worked with all these different different figures in the communist movement and the capitalist movement to lobby the British government into a war. And then you say that you saved children from a war you started, you know. So anyway, that's not even the point. The point is, though, is that Theresa May quoted this man and deferred to him in her speech, which tells you something. That tells you who is she working for? Who are her inspirations and what ends do they want? Yeah. And that very action of quoting Nicholas Winton and deferring to him as a great humanitarian to live by his values and so on. So
that's who she is. Yeah. And I mean, also American politicians have this habit of trying to lend themselves gravitas by quoting Churchill. Well, that seems cool, but like the cult of Churchill is an American thing. It's not a British thing. It's an American thing. And it's because American politicians have done it so long, everyone expects it. But who are they really signaling to? Because who did Churchill work for? You know, we all know.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I mean,
there's nothing really to admire about this man. I mean,
David Irving, if you want to know more, search David Irving stuff on him. If it's still up on the internet, I think you can find it. He basically drags Hitler drags Churchill.
He's not the only one.
Yeah, well, he's not the only one, but his stuff is very good. It's some of the most famous stuff.
It's the best. And you know, not at the risk of being a little paranoid, I think that the advent of David Irving's books in the 70s and the 80s is kind of what may have led some conservatives like Pat Buchanan to write far softer but yet critical books on Churchill as well.
And it was also a favorite you're possibly right. It was also, I mean, say what you will, the libertarian movement, at least the sort of grassroots libertarian movement, not like the big financial stuff, but kind of more like the Ron Paul, like America Patriot, blood of the tree of liberty watered with the blood of tyrants and whatever, blah, like that kind of stuff, which is, there is some authentic grassroots support for that kind of stuff in America that's not purely based around giving big business everything they want. Those guys were doing that too. They were counter signaling Churchill, and they were winking and nodding it. I mean, look, like I said, I was able to get, you know, in the early 2000s, libertarian websites, at least the real libertarian websites, would be more than willing to post Holocaust revisionist stuff on them. They were happy to do it. So
yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, that's a tendency. It's a definite tendency within America. One that a lot of white nationalists end up going through, which has its ups and downs. That's a whole other conversation, though. But I did want to say one more little bit, bottom of the stack item before we go. So we've done about 2 hours now. I just wanted to, you brought up Julian Simon in a debate with Peter Brimlow earlier. Now, there's a funny thing that you mentioned Julian Simon, because he was on the tip of my tongue anyway, even though a lot of people don't know who this guy is. Jewish economist, was a Cato fellow in, I think in definitely in the 80s and the 70s and the 80s. And, he came up because Nathan Koffness, our old buddy, our old pal, was up to his usual tricks, his usual, you know, Nathan Koffness is actually not very good at what he does, even for a Jew. It's pretty funny. He's actually quite bad at it. He was tasked with giving people air cover to say Kevin McDonald had been refuted, and he completely failed. He utterly failed.
Yeah, Jordan Peterson was quoting this man.
Right,
was
but Jordan Peterson
something they planned beforehand.
But Jordan Peterson doesn't do that anymore. Like yeah. I said, Jordan, and he bragged about that to me just last night. Oh, Jordan Peterson quoted my paper. And I'm like, Jordan Peterson was given your paper. Jordan Peterson didn't read your paper. Jordan Peterson was given your paper and told, yeah. This is the thing that refutes all those people that are asking you about Jews at your events.
Mm-hmm.
This is the paper that you're going to say refutes the McDonald thing when they ask. But they don't do that anymore. That's done because it's such a bad paper. And also, Kaufness, actually, you know, we chickened out on debating us. We chickened out on debating McDonald. He suddenly couldn't make it when he was supposed to debate McDonald on Luke Ford. And instead, like, Luke Ford just treated Dr. McDonald to a two-hour snark fest. It was a disgrace.
Yeah. But, I noticed, you know, I'm not going to say Luke Ford is at the center of this or anything, but I noticed that a lot of the trolls, again, I don't usually acknowledge this, but a lot of the trolls that you know send me stupid shit and trying to attack me in disingenuous ways, they all seem to come from that Luke Ford Halsey nexus, that world. They're world.
It's obvious.
It doesn't surprise me, but they're constantly saying, "Oh, this guy's gay. This guy's Jew. Yeah, this guy's not white." This so that's shit. All coming from there. For the most part. So.
I mean, look, Luke Ford clearly had an agenda. The funny thing is he was, and so did Halsey, they're just bad at it. So Luke Ford like tried to cozy up to the alt-right, and people were intrigued, mainly because I wanted to know, like, why the fuck did you convert to Judaism? And I don't give a shit anymore. It's because he's an insane narcissist. But
I was very nice and respectful and friendly to him. But again, that's my boyish, my Aryan trust.
Same thing happened to me and Halsey English. I mean, I was too nice to the guy, and he, you know, he did what he did. But that's irrelevant. Those guys are long in the rearview mirror.
Yeah.
The thing is, Luke Ford was, right after he was nice to us, then he starts promoting Kaufness. Point is, Kaufness says, Kaufness's argument is this. This is why the paper is such a joke and why our talking points on the JQ have already surpassed. He is saying that McDonald's argument and fundamentally the alt-right's argument on the JQ is that Jews are left-wing. That's what he is claiming our argument is. Now, he knows that's not true. He has to know that's not true. If he doesn't know that's not true, then he's really dumb, and I don't think he's totally dumb.
He's an Oxford professor.
He's not dumb. So he knows that he's lying. So he tweets out yesterday, this is how alt-writers who learn history from Kevin McDonald get a distorted worldview. He's retweeting a Kevin McDonald tweet about Paul Ehrlich, who wrote a book called The Population Bomb that turned out to be completely wrong, but was used to kind of scare like middle-class white liberals into this sort of, we can't have babies and environmentalist crap, right? Stupid shit like that. So anyway, so McDonald's talking about this. Kaufness retweets me, says, this is how writers who learn history from Kevin McDonald get a distorted worldview. Sounds like Ehrlich was up to the usual Jewish tricks. But his famous opponent was another Jew, Julian Simon, who argued for more population growth and opposed birth control. Now, there's a lie there. Okay, Julian Simon did not oppose birth control. But Julian Simon is a radical Cato Institute scholar and open borders fanatic. And Kaufness doesn't tell his audience that. And he knows that, too. He says he argued for more population growth through immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't against birth control because he was a libertarian. He's going to be for birth control. He's a Jew and a libertarian. He's not against birth control. He's against, quote-unquote, population control, which means some sort of eugenics because he's Jewish. Because their history with that issue. And on top of that,
Peter Brimelow, Peter Brimelow actually addressed that because the Jew Simon was saying, "Oh, we need mass immigration because there's not enough people for the jobs available." Which, by the way, is a total
straw man,
wrong values, whatever that is. But even that, Brimelow responded. He's like, "Well, you realize that the Native American population growth was actually larger than it is today with the immigration because people had a lot more children back then. So if your problem is that you need more people, well, then we should have." You know, he didn't say this exactly, but the insinuation was that maybe we should have more pronatalist policies if that's the issue. I mean, how did people deal with this issue before? Well, I'll tell you how. You know, three generations ago, people had 12 children. Yeah. And that's actually more of a population growth than mass immigration. So the point is that it totally right what you're saying is that Ehrlich and Simon were kind of riffing off each other. They weren't debating.
No.
They were creating a thesis and antithesis and forming a synthesis.
It's a perfect kosher – it's an almost pristine example of a kosher sandwich, actually. It's funny. It's like an ideal example. And the funny thing is Ehrlich did make a splash with his book, The Population Bomb. It was a widely read book and a widely discussed book and a popular book. Simon used that as a launch pad to make himself a known figure briefly, and then to promote Cato Institute and promote open borders immigration policy. So
the Cato
you
Institute
exactly
is even
see,
worse than most left wing think tanks.
Yeah,
by
and
way,
so it's like, and it's funny because I didn't remember Julian Simon by name, but I remembered that Ehrlich was in a debate. I remember from back libertarian days this whole argument, and I remembered that Ehrlich was in a debate with some right wing economist. Or nominally right-wing economist, over this issue. And I just Googled Julian Simon, and I looked, and I was like, oh, now I see exactly what's going on. So it's really funny that in his dishonesty and in his attempt to do the bit, well, oh, you say Jews are all leftists, well, here's a right-wing Jew. Kopnis instead totally reinforces our thesis about how the kosher sandwich operates, how the thesis and antithesis, and it's like, the thesis is simple. Jews take differing positions within a framework that benefits them and disadvantages us.
Yep.
It's very simple.
Exactly.
And then they form
that into a syncretic policy where they impose both. You get both.
Where you get a little of each. You get the mass immigration and you get white people having less children. Wow.
And you know, no offense to Peter Brimelow. This is constructive criticism, but my God, it was painful to watch that. The man was clinging to his facts. And this Jew is just one knuckleball pitch after another. You know, the reason Julian Simon will debate Peter Brimelow in 1995, but Nathan Kopnis will not debate Eric Stryker and Mike Enoch in 2019 is because you and I, we read Mein Kampf. We know how to hit your fucking knuckleball, bruh. So throw those curves at us, and we're just gonna fucking knock them out of the park every time. We know what to expect from you. We know what you're doing.
Yeah, and on top of that, this is a perfect example where if Kopnis got into a debate with us and this came up, Paul Ehrlich came up. He's hoping that you don't understand what that debate was. He's hoping you don't know who Julian Simon is, and you won't look. He's hoping you're just going to take his word for it. I'm not going to take his word for it. Even if I didn't know who Julian Simon was, all you got to do is search him. And like I said, I did a thing where I even, in my own mind, I made a bet with myself, I bet you this guy's going to be like some libertarian. And boom, I was right.
Yep.
And so so my theory is not only better than Kopnis's, it's predictive, and it's predictive of what Kopnis himself will do.
You know,
and so
he
knows this. He knows that he said he wouldn't. Yes. And then he says to me, oh, you're an ignoramus and a blowhard. All right, fine. I'll admit I'm a blowhard, but I'm not an ignoramus. And you know that, too. And that's why you won't debate me. If you thought you could humiliate
me. He's an ignoramus.
Well, I'll tell you this. If he thought he could humiliate us, that was pretty bad. If he thought he could humiliate us, he would do it. He would debate us. Because when I debated Halsey, you know, Halsey didn't debate me. He just started attacking my personal life, and he knew I was unprepared to talk about that because of various reasons, and so he just kept hammering it. And so that was my mistake for doing that. I shouldn't.
That's why you refused. Remember that when Halsey
he refused to debate you because he didn't have any dirt on you.
Right. He was planning to debate.
Maybe if he got in prep
to talk about he was planning to debate Duke. And what is it?
Yeah, he had prep on that. Let's just
This guy was a womanizer, but he had that kind of shit.
He had plastic surgery and blah, blah,
right,
blah.
Right, he was going to do that. And that's how Jews operate. So if they can't – so if a Jew can't trick you or just overpower you with their verbal tricks like they did with – frankly, I mean they overpowered Brimelow. Brimelow had all the facts. He had all the truth. He had all the research. But he got totally wrecked by this Jew because this guy just kept throwing curveballs at him and he didn't know how to hit them. But you know, once you learn how to hit them, then the Jew turns into a 16 or 17-year-old girl.
Yeah.
They turn into a 16-year-old mean girl, and they start calling you names and characterizing you and starting rumors about you and making insinuations about you. That's what they do when they've lost the debate. They are reduced back to their original form, which is an infantile and crude and cruel little creature. And so that's why, you know, Coffin is a man, I would assume, a man of his great prestige and status as an Oxford dude wouldn't be able to resort to that. But then again, I don't know. He wouldn't be able to resort to that, so he's just not
going. Oh, he's at Oxford. Damn it. He's going to make fun of the fact that I said Harvard.
Oh, okay.
Whatever. Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. I knew he was at a really prestigious institution. Yeah, it's Oxford, right? But whatever. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't change any of my arguments. I just said Harvard instead of Oxford.
It's all interchangeable anyway. It
doesn't really matter. Yeah, right? I mean, but that's exactly the kind of thing. See, that's one thing with Jews. You got to be careful on that stuff, because if you make that mistake, they'll go right in on that, and they won't let you out of it. If you're like, oh, mixed up Harvard and Oxford, whatever, let's get back to the point. No, he'll focus on that for the next 10 minutes.
Right, so, but then your job is not to do –
But you can't let them. You just can't let them. You'll be like, no.
If you're like a good-natured WASP, like a WASP intellectual, you're just going to get taken off into left field with that because you're not used to that. You're not – a customer climate.
Because he's not being charitable. A debate between WASPs, the two will be charitable to each other on stuff like that.
Right.
Cop doesn't want to give you any charity. He just wants to humiliate you. That's the whole point. So if you know going in that somebody doesn't want to debate an issue, they want to use the debate as a forum to humiliate you in order to score a moralizing political victory, which is what Jews tell you they want to do. Read David Horowitz. He tells you that this is what he wants to do in his books on politics and political rhetoric and stuff. The object is to destroy the enemy, not to talk to them. No. That's how Jews operate. And so
and that's why that's knowing, the philosophy of Antifa that they get from the Jews.
Yes. Yes.
Their philosophy. It's very clear what they say. I read this in the Jewish Current recently. The Jewish Current is this like kind of communist, neoliberal communist magazine. Mm-hmm. And what they were saying in that is, if you're a communist or an anarchist, don't have a discussion with the fascists and the Nazis. You can have a discussion with the libertarians of reason because those guys are easy to beat. But don't discuss anything with the Mike Enochs and Eric Strikers of the world. What you need to do instead is to take away their platform and shut them up because we can't win that argument.
They said that I saw an Antifa account on Twitter a little while ago when someone made the mistake of engaging with a quote-unquote fascist and they weren't having a good time of it. And they were like, throwing my hands up, this is why we tell you, you know, these people lie all the time, but they're very good at rhetoric and propaganda, which is, you know, the fascist ideal is itself a lie. Of course, it's all projection, right? But it's that's their thing. The deplatforming, no platform for fascists. They don't say no platform for conservative libertarians.
No, you know what's funny too is that the reason the left is we're going to end up obliterating them, the Judeo left, is because they don't even understand what fascism and National Socialism and ideas like this are, or even the new third positionism. They don't, because in their mind, what the reason, the superficial reasoning they have is that because third positionism is open ended and not bound to any specific doctrine, that it can take any form and thus be appealing to many people. But that's the point of populism, though, you know. And so, but what they're missing though is that there is a deeper seated deep seated world philosophy in nationalism. Okay, because there's never been in history, in human history, there's never truly been a formless worldview that has been successful. If you look at Christianity or Islam or communism or any of these other things, bad or good, they were a world philosophy. They had a doctrine. They were they had a set of social ethic principles and things like that. So. They had a lifestyle, associated with them. So these philosophies that took over the world at various points in history, had a form. So how are you going to say that about the other world philosophies like National Socialism or fascism, third positionism, these things that took Europe and much of the world by storm at the time? I mean, there's fascists in Japan, there's fascists in South America, in Africa, and all over the world. So how are you going to say that this is a totally formless, cynical thing? Like it's kind of idiotic. Now, where that critique does perhaps work is with some of the populace in Europe, maybe, but it doesn't work with us. And I think they do understand that on a deeper level, which is why they, you know, they have a hard time. It's like I was saying on Twitter, you know, the SPLC and a bunch of these really spurgier anarchist types were having a mental breakdown because Thomas Fazi, who is a member of the Five Star Movement in Italy, he retweeted something I said. Because he's like a consistent leftist. He's a sincere Italian leftist. He's against the European Union. He's against the bankers. He's against open borders. So he retweeted something I said, one retweet, and he got dogpiled by all these anarchists and the SPLC stalkers and all these weirdos and stuff. So if my ideology and the things I say are as stupid and ignorant and ghoulish and unappealing and unpopular as you say we are, why do you have a heart attack when two men exchange a single idea? Why? Would you get neurotic and nervous if, you know, a fat, ugly nerd came up to your girlfriend and started chatting with her? I don't think so. You wouldn't get mad at that. So why you know, it's more of the guy she tells you not to worry about of a scenario. So yeah. Clearly they know that our ideas are popular too. They know that yeah. Our ideas are super appealing. We're the sexy ones here. All right. So don't ever believe that demoralizing propaganda that they put out that, oh, you know, your ideology is sickening and people are sickened by you and you're just 1% of the population.
People that are sickened by it are themselves mentally ill. They're mentally ill foot soldiers that are probably into, I mean, what was it? Someone, going through one of these Antifa documentaries, somebody picked out the Antifa 14 words, which was I'm Jewish, I'm queer, I'm a trans woman, and those things are all related.
Yeah.
That's the Antifa really 14 words. I don't know if that's 14 words or not. I think it might be.
Do you really think we're less popular than someone who believes like that?
I mean,
like,
that there's
does
no
anyone
way.
Believe that? Come on.
I mean, they wear masks.
You know, that's why you know again, this goes back to gaslighting. They spend millions of dollars to find, you know, to police us in the private sphere mostly, but sometimes in the public sphere they try. You know, because they want you to get the feeling that your ideas are unpopular so that you stop saying them. So, like, you know, when you go and you lose your job because these professional activists and Jewish trolls go and fuck with your boss and say, oh, we're going to give you bad publicity if you don't fire this person. You know, the other aspects, like having people that have activists coming out against their rallies and so on, well, those people are professionals. Like, you know, the 90% of the people that went to that Dayton – you know, invisible glow in the dark nights of the Ku Klux Klan rally. And again, I kid my Klan friends out there, but those people are bust in. Those are people that are professionals or people that have like funds of money from the DSA or from trust fund anarcho kitties. And they get bust out to these places, these random ass things. And you know, it's funny that's actually
like entertainment for them.
It's like going to Woodstock or a concert. Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's like that was like their big thing. Like, they loved that, the fact that a rally was happening. I mean, that rally was it was irrelevant. Who cares? Whatever. It didn't.
I don't know if they. No, they didn't love. Maybe the people, the rank and file, loved it, but the people that pay for this stuff don't love it because it's movement attrition.
It was
attrition.
Very expensive for them. Yeah, that's pretty funny.
It's movement attrition. We all know the cost of actually traveling and doing activism. It is expensive. So someone's paying for that, and you know, if you're going to be paying a lot of money to bus people in and transport people and put them up in lodging to go out to Dayton
for six guys
in Klan hoods, and I think one guy was wearing a Gestapo uniform. Like, is that really worth it? Is it really worth it? I mean, I think there's probably more Klansmen on the Jerry Springer show, you know. So, you know, and that one is free. So, I mean, you know, it is. It actually is kind of a good thing that those guys do those rallies because, you know, by doing that, they waste their time and money that they could be using for like things that matter, you know,
and energy and the energy of the people that are wanting to do that sort of thing, because that's what they want to do. Like, they, you know, a lot of these, they're not very low time preference people. Like, that's the thing. It's like, oh, look, we went and we yelled at these guys, and then they left and we claimed victory, and it was fun, and then we went and did drugs. You know, like, that's it was like a big, it was like, yeah, it was like a Woodstock concert for them. And yeah, the guy footing the bill is not pleased because he's like, what the hell did this? In the end, we could have just not covered this in the media and it would have been the same result.
Yeah, exactly. They have this, you know, the cost of these organizations like the DSA and so on. You know, they need money for other things. Like, I don't agree with the people that say that George Soros funds Antifa. It's simply not true. I've yet to see any hard evidence of that.
That's just I mean, yeah, if you're going to make statements like that, you got to have some kind of evidence. George Soros funds a lot of stuff, but, you know, and there is evidence that Antifa is funded, but who's doing it?
I'll tell you what I think, and this is as an ex-leftist who has in the past known Antifas and so on. The way it usually works is that – so liberals, neoliberals are accomplices to Antifa, but they're not funding them. What they do instead is they let the Antifas use their venues for planning for free. You know, they send lawyers for them. They send cover, you know, because if you have the peacenik liberals in the tie-dye shirts, the boomer liberals holding up the peace sign in the front, and then you have the black-masked violent criminals behind them, they can hide like that. And the liberals know that they're hiding them. So what happens is that at these rallies, when there's liberals and Antifa, the anarchists go, they commit crimes, they beat people and so on, and they assault people, and then they run back to the regular protests and hide behind the liberals, and then when the cops come chasing, the liberals are like, hey man, we're just liberals, we're part of the Democratic Party, don't you dare touch us because we're Democrats. And so that's kind of how the actual liberal collaboration works. Not to mention, of course, the amazingly fawning press. So you have Chris Cuomo praising Antifa on fucking CNN, you know. So they do provide them plenty of moral, political, cultural, and so on, institutional support in that way. Now, money, you know, like big money to Antifa, it really is for them. These are people that are just mentally ill, and they're doing it out of their own volunteer time. I mean, imagine if the George Soros accusation for Antifa specifically is kind of the conservative version of what leftists do with the 4chan memers and trolls, saying that they're Russians. You know, it's kind of like a mirror image of that, and it's just stupid all around. There's just lots of young people that don't have a job or have a lot of time on their hands that have taken up these different policies, politics, and movements as a way to find meaning in their life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. But that was kind of a field of where I wanted to go with just the Kaufness story. But
let's go back to Kaufness. Let's finish that off.
Well, I don't know if there's much else. I think the main point is that Kaufness is a one-trick pony, and that trick is, hey, look, Jews aren't just left-wing. There's right-wing Jews, too. And it's like, well, that's kind of our whole point.
Actually. Well, okay, let's take the Jew thing out of it, just to be charitable. If, you know, when I say the Jew thing, I mean that the idea that Jews are motivated entirely by ethnic self-interest and in and of itself.
Oh, yeah.
Let's take that out of it. Fine. Just to be charitable. How about this? One thing that Jews do contribute to both the left and the right is liberal ideas. Yes. So the goyim on both sides are actually, frankly, a liberal. On the right, they are religious. They love their church. The goyim, you know, then they have stronger family values. And on the left, they're anti-capitalists. So Jews, when they enter these movements, what they do is they kind of subvert them in a direction where you drop the anti-capitalism, you drop the family values and law and order, and you become what Donald Trump is becoming, a warmongering neocon who's also going to let all the blacks out of prison.
Yeah.
That is the Jewish contribution. So Jews, at the very least, contribute liberal ideas that are extremely unpopular with the population.
Yeah, and they also slap themselves on the back for that. Like they congratulate themselves for that. Like, if you look at their, like, again, just look at a lot of what they say when they think it's not everyone's watching, or it's just their own, like, fan base watching, or just Jews or whatever. They will openly say, yes, the great thing about Jews is the wonderful liberal ideas that we've brought to the discourse, to these benighted goyim that would be just stupid and, you know, living in their church-based fascist state, you know, without us or something like that. So
yeah. So but those things,
they
why,
tell you
why?
Themselves. When you also look at what Jews brag about, and is that something that is good for you?
Right. And that's something like Koffness, you know, doesn't really engage with that. I mean, Koffness, again, he takes things out of context. He makes insinuations. That's because he's fundamentally dishonest. He has a mission.
Yeah.
He gets the facts later.
Yeah, his mission was to create an academic an appearance that there was an academic refutation of McDonald's book. That was his mission, because for years McDonald was saying, well, no one's refuted my book because no one will engage with it. And I suspect it's because they are afraid to touch the topic. And he was absolutely right.
I wouldn't be surprised if organized Jewry was involved in putting Koffness up for that.
I'm sure, dude.
Because,
I'm
you know,
sure that
after,
there was some...
After Koffness failed, not long after, maybe
then
months
the
after,
book was banned.
The book was banned.
Yeah, amazing.
Koffness failed to
Koffness didn't deliver the goods, and they had to remove the book from the shelves. If he had dismantled McDonald's argument, if he had refuted the book, why wouldn't they allow it to continue to be sold? Here's another example. I mean, you can buy Mein Kampf because they think that that's been refuted. They also are quite sure you won't read it.
Yeah.
And they also the copy that you can get is riddled with, you know.
No, you can get all types of copies, yeah. But that's like kind of like, you know, they see, you know, some of the references are outdated and so on, although some of them are
it's not the same thing
as writing about Jews in America.
Yeah.
Today. Yeah. Like, it's not the same. So like that's why the McDonald is an academic.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the other thing is that
Koffness's credentials here, the way he presented himself at first was that he himself is a race realist, by the way.
Oh, I know. That's another thing. Yeah.
So he is all for you talking about haplogroups and DNA IQ stuff and, you know, who has the high IQ, who has the low IQ. That's okay. You can actually do that. You can be at Oxford and do that, and your books won't be banned from
Jewish.
Amazon. Right, if you're Jewish. But even if you're not, like Douglas Murray and so on, he does that.
Yeah, I mean, within a certain perspective. I mean, you can go
as long
further.
As, you do it as long as your conclusions are conservative, then you're allowed to do that.
Yeah.
To a point. I mean, they're increasingly, you know, tampering with this access to knowledge.
I think you meant Charles Murray also, by the way.
Charles Murray, sorry.
Yeah.
But the point I'm making.
But Charles Murray comes under fierce attack. And his books, I don't think his book, I'm not sure if the bell curve has been removed from Amazon. I'll be surprised.
No.
He comes under a fierce attack, though, but Koffness does not from the left.
He comes
Koffness
up,
gets
he
no
comes,
attack.
You know, so it's a matter of gradient, right? Just like the league in Italy comes under fierce attack from anarchists and campus leftists and things like that. They do. Even parts of the media, they come under fierce attack. The dog pile is lighter if you play ball with the Jews. That's just how it is.
Well, Charles Murray also had a Jewish co-author on that book, and I wonder what the reception would have been.
It's an intellectually interesting book. Again, people, we're not saying you have to absolutely, you know, never engage with any idea ever again, blah, blah. No one is saying that. What we're saying is you have to learn how to think and think critically. When you're engaging with this stuff, that way worms like Koffness can't get into your play tricks on you, because Koffness is a trickster. He's going out there. He's like, oh, well, I'm actually racist too.
Well, that's how you know this was a psyop. I mean, he was, and I think that it was a poorly executed one. And I think you're right. There might have been some Jewish involvement there, because it wasn't necessarily to convince, I think, the public at large. He was targeting the alt-right. Because if he was targeting the public at large, he wouldn't have... I mean, his argument was... And he was targeting kind of... You know what he was really kind of targeting? He kind of hit the mark in some cases, but there's just not that big of an audience for it. So he's kind of going for this sort of Spurgy IQ supremacist NRX-y type stuff. You know, like that's yeah. where he's coming from, and he makes the argument Jews actually deserve. I mean, at some point he even he kind of refutes himself where he's saying like he denies Jews are ethnocentric, but then he's a Jew that is obsessed with policing things that people say about Jews, but he won't admit that ethnocentrism played any part of that. But then he says Jews actually deserve their spots at the top because they're so much smarter, but he's not ethnocentric at all. So none of it fits together, really, if you actually look at it. But he does bring in that race realism, saying, oh, the Jewish overrepresentation at the top of the pile is because of their higher IQs. Now, that's not an argument that is generally favored outside of those kind of arguments are very specific to a very sort of autistic and kind of megalomaniacal subsection of the internet who always, of course, think they're the one with the highest IQ. High IQ people should rule, like a mold bug NRX type thing or something like that.
Right.
And Moldbug himself also half Jewish, so he's tapping into that.
The comparison I always make with NRX guys is that they think that they're just King Arthur, but they got like they got off on the wrong stop on the time machine. Like that's kind of how they're Richard the Lionheart who just got off on the wrong stop, and they want to play into that because, you know, to be fair, Mike, that element was actually pretty strong at one point, at least 2015, 2016, and then decent. Oh, right. It was actually probably the dominant strain.
Yeah, well, we've moved well beyond IQ nationalism. I mean, IQ nationalism was a tendency that and Koffness was just behind the curve in that he wrote a book or wrote a paper rather that was meant to appeal to that Spurg, and that's where Luke Ford also kept trying to appeal back to that. And he drew a few people in, but you'll notice that's he's like, oh, the Jews, and look, Jews for a long time have said, oh, the Jews are so smart, they deserve their positions, and they kind of Koffness put like he made like a supposedly scholarly argument. I mean, his paper is actually, even by scholarly standards, like very bad. It's actually just a bad work, and the fact that it also has race realism in it and such, it's well below the standards of an Oxford professor, even if it's bullshit. It's not even good bullshit. That's the funny thing,
right?
About it. And like,
I mean,
so,
it would have been much better for him, you know, because his claim is that he won't debate you or I for prestige reasons. So Koffness has, I believe, debated other people and gone on different live streams that were kind of
My knowledge, has not debated. He's gone on Luke Ford's stream, but only in a friend. He actually was supposed to debate McDonald, but he chickened out. He says he was ill, but I don't believe that for a second.
Yeah.
And somebody was telling me that they have it that Koffness was at that then McDonald went on and talked to Luke, and that Koffness was feeding Luke talking points. I don't know if that's true. It would not surprise me, though.
I remember when I was – last time I was on Luke Ford.
He was in the chat.
He was in the fucking chat. So you're telling me you can't come on and have a scholarly discussion about your paper, but you can lurk in the Spurg chat with people posting fucking the N-word and Kike and Jew and whatever. You can do that. You know. So you tell me what's going on here.
Yeah, Thomas. Well, the reason is because he can't do those. Because, look, the paper is being out there. He can still make the claim like, the paper's out there, McDonald is refuted, and maybe somebody will pick it up and use it. I mean, Jordan Peterson doesn't do that anymore. Nobody really does that. No one's talked about him in a year. I mean, this only happened because a tweet of his came across my desk yesterday. That's the only reason we're talking about it. So, so no one's talking about the guy. He's relegated to the Luke Ford, you know, tiny little dusty corner of the internet, and... So no one's talking about them. He's not generating any excitement, but you know, this is just, you know, it's worth dragging the guy occasionally just to remind everyone that he's full of shit. And but he failed, and he wouldn't debate McDonald because if he has it out there that, oh, you know, Jordan Peterson and Alex Jones, then quote, he says Alex Jones endorsed it. I'm like, that's not necessarily the endorsement you want, guy. Alex Jones endorses a lot of things.
Alex Jones has a big following and something.
I think
what he was trying to do there, so correct me if I'm wrong, if you disagree, but what I think he's trying to do is try to sheathe and insulate the alt-light from our talking points.
Yes, exactly.
That's what he was doing. It wasn't really...
Because the alt-light is not really allergic to race and IQ. You know, no. Like they are perfectly, they're actually pretty open to that. There, but the JQ is a sticking point there, because the alt-light is like a walled garden. It's like a gate-kept little plantation. And its whole purpose is to keep people from coming over to us, right? It's the only reason it exists.
Amazing, but true.
And it's also dying. It's also dying. And that's another reason Koffness doesn't have much amplification, because people like these figures. The funny thing is, who would be amplifying Koffness? Milo. Gavin McGinnis. People that
Alex Jones.
Nora Loomer, Alex Jones, people that they've silenced are the ones that would be amplifying Koffness, because they would be the ones tasked with preventing their audience from going further to the right. For
PJ, you know, Watson.
Yeah, exactly.
PJ Watson. Did PJ Watson share that?
He did, but again, he didn't read it. He just tweeted it. He retweeted a tweet. That's the thing. None of these people read it. Peterson might have read it. Molyneux definitely didn't read it, because... or if he did, he then quickly dropped it, because Molyneux doesn't use his argument. If Molyneux was using Koffness's argument, Koffness would be bragging about it, but he's not. So Molyneux, I think either he read it, he did tweet about it, but he didn't. He got a lot of pushback from his fans for tweeting about it, of people saying, this guy's full of shit, you know better. And I think Molyneux just let it drop there. Again, the paper is bad. It can't, if it was better, a guy like Molyneux could come to its defense, but he can't. His fans won't have it. His fans are spurgy enough that they're like, this is shitty. He's not even addressing the argument. And what can Molyneux do? Because he's cultivated a fan base of spurgs that hyper analyze every argument. So he can't bring out these shitty, obviously shoddy arguments. He just can't do it.
Yeah.
Even if he wanted to, which he does.
I mean, what one could say, one other thing before I forget, just quickly, the league has an African in charge of its immigration policy. Did you know that?
That's so typical.
They have a base black. I mean, you know, if you had a base black in America in charge of immigration, it might not even be a terrible idea. But why is there, first of all, why is there black people in Italy?
Yeah, well, that's
like
true.
That's the first question.
Well, the other thing I said.
Question is why is he your immigration minister?
The other thing I said this to somebody on Twitter who was trying to defend Farage because of the statements about bringing in more blacks, and then some of the optics he was using for Brexit Party, where he was doing ads that were specifically multicultural, like he was sort of specifically making Brexit Party propaganda about multiculturalism, and then the Brexit Party Twitter accounts and Farage and such in the TPUK, you know, Toilet Paper United Kingdom,
they have that shit there.
They have TPUK, and it's a big backer.
Hold on a second. What if some of this subversion isn't even coming from Bannon, but from that crowd?
Well, it is. In the UK, it absolutely is. No. TPUK is a thing, and it's a big backer of Brexit Party. In fact, it's considering Brexit Party to be a big TPUK victory, one of their first victories in the UK. They're absolutely there. And my point was, and I was telling people this, and somebody was like, oh, well, because, like, there's more than, you know, there were non-whites that voted for Brexit and this and that. And I'm like, look, there's one thing if Farage is accepting non-whites, okay? It's like, it's one thing if it's sort of like, all right, it is kind of a nationalist thing. And there are British people, and some of the people that voted for this are people, maybe they've been there longer, maybe they're Sikhs or blacks or something. And they voted for Brexit. It's one thing to accept that. But when you're taking a thing that is like 90% whites that voted for it, and you're specifically signaling multicultural global homo shit, that's a different thing. You see, it's one thing to be like, okay, this is 90% white. It's for England. It's this, that. And there are some blacks here. Fine. That's a little different. Then look at me, I'm out here with all the blacks and the Indians and the Muslims and the these and the that, and it's multicultural and it's homosexual and it's this and, you know,
right.
That's
it's one
different.
Thing. It's one thing if you want to include them as a kind of a small group in your populist coalition. That's I'm not gonna.
Well, you have
get
to
mad
in a country
that.
Like America, like, and the UK. It's
that's fine.
You understand why you'd do that, right?
But it's different when you make them. You know what I would.
Why are they the centerpiece of a 99% white thing?
Exactly. I would compare it to, so I was out a few weeks ago at a pub, and there's a group of blacks, right? So there's like competing. So there's a group of blacks, and this is funny because I've seen this in other cases where you see a group of blacks and they have like one white friend, like a white, especially if it's a white girl.
Oh God.
So, you know, if there's a group of blacks hanging out and, you know, doing their own thing in the corner and there's a white girl, all the attention is on the white girl. And if it's on the white guy, the negative attention is on the white guy. But when there's no white people in the group of blacks, they're very natural, spontaneous. They're having fun. They're laughing. They're joking around. Like, it's very different. So what conservatives do is kind of like an inversion of that.
Yeah, same thing. As you say, same thing happens with white people and base blacks.
Right. And you know what's funny? The base blacks themselves, they like it because they're making money from it. But, you know, if your goal is really to win over, you know, there are decent parts of the black community. You know, there's working people in the black community that don't like crime, don't like immigration, whatever. If your goal is to win those people over, like those are going to be like more sophisticated blacks. They're not going to like being tokenized and treated like, you know, they're going to feel uncomfortable when you do that. You know, because if you're actually colorblind, as these conservatives say they are, you're just going to treat them like anyone else.
Well, blacks make this complaint.
Why are you putting them on a fucking pedestal?
Blacks make this complaint about liberals all the time, and conservatives are now starting to do it as well. And they're
exactly.
Also, and they're actually worse about it, because liberals have done this long enough that they've actually, on some of them, are better at being natural around blacks. Conservatives have no experience in it, and they suck.
No, they just that's my block.
Now, don't get me wrong though. Like white people, whether conservative or liberal, do this to black people. Okay, that's one of the issues that we bring attention to. Is it's very difficult for you to be natural with these people, and that's part that proves our whole position. That like proves our whole point about how race works. Like
this, I saw this fascinating interaction on social media. So Milo Yiannopoulos is being hosted on some Irony Bro podcast in New York City.
It's like a Dirtbag Left podcast, right? Like
it's not really Dirtbag Left, but it is kind of ironic and edgy and so on. And they have connections to the Dirtbag Left. But the point is that like the guy that hosts the podcast is a Puerto Rican guy. Okay, he's a Puerto Rican guy from I don't know where. He's a New Yorker though, and this guy is hosting Milo because he said, I like Milo. He's funny to me. He's a funny troll. And the Antifa were in his they're going nuts over this. They're attacking him like crazy.
He started calling them white.
No. Yeah. So what he said, so the Antifa went on this tweet barrage talking about this is Milo deporting immigrants. This is Milo saying racist, calling black people gorillas. This is Milo engaging in transphobia. And his only response was, speak English, nigga.
Yeah, no, this is like most people get this, but do you think like a Puerto Rican guy from New York, probably from the Bronx or someplace like that, from a Puerto Rican area, you think he gives a fuck about the pearls that these liberals clutch? He does not give a fuck about it. Milo says something about faggots.
He said, speak English, nigga.
Milo says like, he makes fun of fat black mammies or something like that, like he did with Leslie Jones. That guy thinks that's funny. He thinks it's hilarious to call Leslie Jones an ape. Okay, I guarantee you, Puerto Rican comedian from the Bronx thinks it's fucking hilarious to call Leslie Jones an ape. Guaranteed. 100%. Take it to the fucking bank. Guaranteed. He also thinks it's funny to make fun of faggots. Guaranteed.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Get the hell out of here with
trannies.
Yeah, and trannies, forget about it. He will punch you for even coming near him as a tranny. So, yeah. So the Antifa really barking up the wrong tree, doing their liberal pearl clutching with an actual, you know, street level Puerto Rican from like wherever he's from, Brooklyn, Bronx, whatever neighborhood. It's not going to fly. Like, you think that those people are like Bronx Blogger? They're not.
No.
Bronx Blogger does not fit in that community.
Presenting. He's very white presenting.
He's Bugman presenting.
He's a Bugman, yeah. he said, actually, Bronx Blogger said he considers himself to be white. So,
I remember when I was talking about the Puerto Rican community in New York and my experiences, and look, let's be honest. If you want to, I know people, don't use the word race, whatever, it doesn't matter. They'll target white people. If you're white and alone walking through their neighborhood, you're going to get targeted. You're going to get targeted racially. You're going to get yelled, hey, white boy, whatever they're going to yell, and they're going to make you feel scared. And they're going to think it's funny when you get scared. I've experienced it. I've seen it.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Everyone knows it. Okay. And it's a known thing. And I was talking to Bronx Blogger about this, and he's like, oh, so you, some Puerto Ricans scared you? So I'm like, it doesn't matter. The point is, I'm telling you that this is what the racial relationships between these groups are like. And you can't pretend like it's not true. You're just going to pivot to making fun of me for being that scared white boy or whatever. But look, you walk through a black neighborhood and tell them you're a transsexual, Bronx. Right? But yes, I've had the experience of walking through a Puerto Rican neighborhood and been targeted for being white. I'm not ashamed of it. It's just a thing that happens. It's life in fucking New York City. What do you want me to tell you?
Why do you think hipsters? So what they
hipsters are deathly afraid of that.
You know what the great troll this guy is? I think is Luis Guzman or Luis Gomez. That's his name. And his troll. So the Antifa were able to get the venue that he was going to use to kick him out. So his troll is that now they I think they hosted it already. I'm not sure. I haven't been following it.
I know. Yeah, it was
the troll was that they were going to host it in Washington Heights, and his logic was that well, none of these white hipsters are going to come up that high in the city.
He also gave a He also gave a password that you had to say to get in, which was racist. Like he's like, "Give me the plot the nose, nigga." Like you had to say, "Give me the plot the nose, nigga," in order to get in. And so, no white hipster is going to say that.
No white hipster is going to say.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, right?
He said, "Go you can find the venue by."
I think he literally said, "You'll get
saying, give me the plot the nose, nigga.
Hand over them plot nose, nigga." Yeah. It's pretty funny, pretty clever.
You know, fuck it. I like that guy.
Say nigger. I think he's funny. I was gonna say to him, "Why are you even responding to these fucking pearl clutching faggots?" But I just
that's what I do. Yeah, I stuck my spoon in that thread, which is causing some nasty.
I mean, look, I don't even want to do the bit of like out there. I don't even want to do the bit of like I'm more down with the community of color or whatever. But it's actually in this case, it's true. Like I could talk to that guy, and you could talk to that guy way easier than any fucking gay hipster bugman Antifa could. Because
if you're like hanging out with your friend somewhere, and you know he hears you say something like the N word loudly, or making racist jokes, or saying things like talk about Jews,
mad. Yeah, obviously
that guy's Jews, gonna be like, that guy's gonna either be like, "Yo, that's mad funny," or he's just not gonna care and mind his own business. You know, the hipster and the bug man, on the other hand, pulls out his camera phone and starts to film you. It's like, where do you work? Okay, well, so in also. A sense, well, some of the things Puerto Ricans and blacks, you know, what they hate about white people is actually, you know, they're not wrong. What they hate about white people, those guys don't actually, you know, they have rivalries and they do, you know, they will fucking fuck with you and rob you and shit, but they don't actually hate the Italians and Irish and working class white people that, you know, may linger in their areas. The people they hate are these transplants.
They hate the uptight middle class faggot bullshit bug man nerds.
Fucking nerds coming from other parts of the country to their fucking areas, not just pricing them out of their own neighborhoods, but also making them super gay. So, you know, they have like the corner sports bar where they go and they fucking fuck around, they joke around. Okay, suddenly now that sports bar has been closed and turned into a yoga studio.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's what they hate. It's actually misplaced. You know, some people might get offended, like say, "Oh, they hate white people." Some of them do, or at least resent.
Well,
But some of the things they hate are things we hate too.
Well, that's what I was gonna say. Like working class whites and us hate those things too, and those people are equally nervous around working class white people as they are. Maybe not with the racial element. They might not be nervous that violence will be done to them, but they'll be socially nervous around working class whites the way they would be around Puerto Ricans and such. But yeah, but it's, look, it's just, it's because that culture is actually really gay and inauthentic and bullshit and faggoty.
And it's annoying.
And everybody knows it.
Who the fuck is
like, I actually would call, you know, I'm a white nationalist, but I would rather hang out with the Puerto Rican like that guy than I would with a fucking faggot hipster. I just would.
I'll tell you what. I mean, the truth of the matter is that the New York was it New York City Antifa, you know, who the fuck asked for their opinion on who these people want to host? Like, where
are you talking about, like, colonizing over spaces for people of color? Milo wasn't colonizing the space. He was invited.
He's also gay. So that's like a gay oppressed person.
And Jewish.
Yeah. Well, you know what? He might not even be.
I know. I think I don't. Even
I think he's lying
he
about
that. He does not look screwed. Jewish to me, but whatever.
No. He doesn't look Jewish at all.
No. He doesn't act
Milo, not but not, Milo, when he was younger, he was handsome. He was a normal handsome guy. He doesn't have like a big hook nose or like the weird
no, he does not
inbred look.
You wouldn't guess he was by looking at him. Also, he doesn't. He's also even said stuff like, you know, I'm gay, but like being gay is bad. Like you shouldn't be gay. It's bad for you. He said that. I mean, I don't know if he I don't know if he would say that every time you asked him, but he did say that once. He also used to go up here talk about black crime. He'd say black women look like apes.
Exactly.
I mean, there's a reason the guy got popular. But
I mean,
anyway.
they find him funny. And so the point is, like, you know, why are people – like, this is something that I see changing now. And we can end on this. What I see changing is I'm seeing more and more people put their foot down against these fucking children, these fucking tyrannical children that do this Lord of the Flies thing where they dogpile you, intimidate you into basically restricting who you can talk to, who you can hang out with, who you can read and who you can listen to and who you can talk to on your podcast.
Well, the problem is that
these
they're
fucking
using
assholes keep fucking trying to control people in that direction. And I'm noticing very drastically, this is a radical change. This they had a lot of power after Charlottesville, but it's already dwindling.
Yeah, it's
people
it's,
are putting their foot down.
People hate them a lot. And on top of that, you know, they're using a method of control that works on middle class people, works on bougie people, would work on them. It's all about status, prestige, shame, calling people. But do you think if some Puerto Rican gives a fuck?
Oh, God, no.
Well, one, he's also got his own community.
Well,
his own community that will back him against some faggot white people no matter what, right? So he like some faggot white hipster is trying to shame him because Milo said a racism and Milo did a homophobia. And he's like, fuck you, nigga. And no one cares. And every Puerto Rican, every Puerto Rican is siding with him. Right? So what the fuck does he care what these faggots' opinion is? He's got his own community. And that's what we need to develop. We need to develop that attitude. Fuck you, faggot. I don't care what you say because I've got my community. I've got this whole group of fascist white guys behind me. So fuck you.
Exactly. And I think, you know, ultimately, too, the amount of censorship on art and comedy and music that's going on right now, like, that's starting to piss
everything
people
sucks.
Off.
Nothing's funny. Even Jewish stuff that was funny in the past. Even though entertainment has been Jewed forever, some of it was fucking funny. I mean, people can still talk nostalgically about stuff that was funny when they were kids, things that they liked, things that the humor, maybe it was, you know, degenerate or whatever, but there was funny stuff. Now they clutch their pearls so hard. I mean, look, think about this. The Antifa themselves had to use ineffective insult words like chud and jabroni because they can't use words that are actually insulting. Right?
I haven't heard jabroni.
They use jabroni. They call people jabronis and chuds because those are words that don't mean anything and don't hurt anyone's feelings. That's how gay they are.
Didn't The Rock invent that word?
I don't even remember.
Jabroni.
It would make sense if it was made up by, like, you know, some global homo corporatized superstar.
Jabroni. I can't even believe
the point is that it's that. Like I saw a picture of some Antifa marching with a sign that said, like, get lost, jabronis, or something like that. And I'm like, are you people fucking kidding me?
I can't believe it.
Hitting levels of inauthenticity.
One subtle thing I'd point out. Is that I think a lot of the rehashes and remakes, I mean, you know, they're making another Men in Black movie. They remade Pet Sematary. They remade Suspiria, which, you know, whoever funded that remake of Suspiria, you're going to fucking pay one day. When we take power, I'm going to put you up in front of Crimes Against Humanity.
Oh, yeah, no, it was really bad. Like,
one of my favorite movies, man. I love Argento.
I didn't
– Argento was just so unironic and sincere, even though his scripts were awful. but you know, he's just the atmosphere and everything totally lost.
Yeah, the remake of it was dead. I didn't see it, but a friend of mine did go to see it, and they were excited because they liked the original as well, and they were like, "This is." They're like the it was totally flat and dead and boring, and I just left because it was.
But the point I'm making though is that the reason there's so much remakes and they're just it seems like they're out of ideas. It's not that they're out of ideas. It's that the spectrum of ideas is a lot smaller. You can't do say present portray too many things. And it's stifled our art and culture to the point where, like, they can't do anything but make another Men in Black movie or make a comic book movie.
I mean, comic book movies have become so prevalent because they don't challenge any social boundaries. It's purely just a bunch of – it's, like, literally purely just a bunch of crap for kids.
It's propaganda.
Like, yeah, it's just,
propaganda.
Well, it's propaganda, but it's also – it doesn't – it is propaganda. It's been propaganda. It's always been propaganda. But it's also like what boundary – it's like because it's all fantasy and made up. They can create whatever. They're not making any social commentary. They're showing you multicultural hero team in tights fights Purple Man. Like who gives a shit, right? Like and it's just like, okay, sure, graphics and blah-bitty-blah, but there's nothing really there. It's very boring really. Once you're not 14 anymore, or you know, once you're older than 14, and
what they'll say is that oh, but look at all the money they're making. Yeah, but that's because like they have access to markets in China and India and stuff like that.
And look, they hype it up, people go and see shit because what else are they gonna do?
Yeah,
you know, on some level, like it's true. Like they go and see it because whatever.
Right. Yeah, but the problem is that it's degrading our culture to the point of infantilism, the point where, you know, we've talked about this plenty already, but my theory on why they're just digging up old stories and putting them back on the screen, but except shitty, is that they it's not that they're out of ideas, it's that they can't – first of all, the people they have in charge of this – have become gayer and more female. I mean, that's not to take away from women. There are some very great – Leni Riefenstahl, one of the greatest movie directors ever. But with that said, the way women are selected to represent their gender in Hollywood is not – it's not for their not for their skill.
Well, women
– not for their skill in with the camera at least.
Well, also women tend to be more interested in enforcing the social norms than in pushing against them. So, you know, that's what you're going to get there. But yeah, like
one exception, which is the British Union of Fascists was actually, I don't know if people know this, the ideological founders, aside from Mosley, were actually it was women. There's a lot of women that were involved in founding the BUF.
Well, yeah, he had a big women's wing because they were worried about. You know, they were worried about their families and their kids and stuff like that. And that's that he was deliberately cultivating that. But that's I see what you mean. But
Nora Elam, who was a very famous British suffragette, was one of the main ideological.
This made Antifa that era that the Antifa from that era. This made them very pissed.
Very uncomfortable.
Why would she go to fascism? Well, I know I can get why. I can understand exactly why.
She said it. I've read some of her stuff, and she says she's like basically what she says is like, you know, I fought all these years for the right of women to vote, then I voted and nothing happened. Right. So, that was why she became a fascist, and the very big women's wing. And it was composed largely of suffragettes, which is really fascinating. Which is why you know I think we need to have a nuanced view. We have to stick by traditional gender rules, absolutely. But we also need a revolutionary, you know, I'll even say the taboo word, I'll say a revolutionary feminism, which rejects abortionism and anti-children and anti-male, and instead embraces actual feminine nature, which is to be mothers and wives and stewards of
well. I mean, so-called feminism, I mean, this is an old argument, and we're not the first to make it, but it's really not – there's nothing feminine about it. I mean, it's emphasizing – it's basically making women second-rate men instead of women, and that's, you know –
Right. We need a new wave of feminism that makes women first-rate women.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you have to, you know, it doesn't mean, you know, something.
It means
know.
Breeding stumps. I'm joking.
Yeah, it doesn't exactly mean that, you know, but women can have there can be a revolutionary feminism, national revolutionary feminism, where women can be militant and they can participate in politics to an extent. But it needs a total overhaul, and we need women to actually step up. And, you know, no offense to women that do the trad wife podcasts and stuff. That's great too. And trust me, I love that stuff because, you know, you cook me a great meal, whatever. But we also need women that have a philosophical and political or social ethical alternative to feminism. It can't just be, okay, the alternative feminism is I'm going to teach you how to sew and I'm going to teach you how to make this pot pie. It can't be just that. There needs to be more to it.
It can't be that, and then also the other alternative is, like, you know, weird antisocial crazy misogynistic stuff that, you know, can be funny.
I wouldn't use the word misogynistic because that word is kind of abstract and it's kind of like racist or homophobic. It's kind of abstract in that sense. But the, you know, if, you know, a lot of guys, MGTOWs, they're libertarianism, right?
Well, that's the thing. MGTOW is the end result of libertarianism. That was actually a very early article on TRS was actually called MGTOW is the end result of anarcho-capitalism.
Well, you know what I'll say about that? You know, these guys, their primary identity is not being communist. That they're pure reaction. They just want to be whatever a communist is. They want to be the exact opposite. No matter, even if the communist says things like, "Hey, we shouldn't rape children," like in the case of,
well, you know. Hey, you're closer to the mark than you think. But yeah, because of that, their arguments. You know how you look at the kosher sandwich, and you find that ultimately, you know, when you get Ben Shapiro arguing with a liberal, ultimately they're arguing about who's better at keeping out the Nazis. It's the same thing with anarcho-capitalism, just with communism.
So
I mean, that's how the arguments end.
So back to the point I was making. Is that MGTOW is actually a form of communism. And I know it sounds crazy. Let me explain. It's a form of communism because it is it's an ideology of class struggle. So it takes the – really, it is.
You're right. It is.
It's an idea. It's men going on strike in a form of class struggle against women.
Yes, because they're – by their ideology, women are monopolizing – the means to sexual intercourse. They are monopolizing and not just the means, but the means to choice in sexual intercourse. They feel that they don't get a say in who is having sex and who is not, but that's because sex has never been democratic like that. And I would definitely countersignal the idea that women are purely the ones that get to select. But anyway, I mean,
I'll say this. It's the problem with the MGTOWs is that they engage in a form of class struggle, but they don't have any ends because they're libertarians. So if you're going to engage in class struggle, which is wrong because, you know, as nationalists, we don't want that. We want men and women to get along as nature intended. And so what I would argue is that if MGTOW was a serious movement, they would be lobbying and fighting the government to do something about the antagonism between men and women, you know, to reconcile that antagonism. You know, I read recently the manifesto of the Alliance for Peace and Freedom. This was a European parliamentary group that was composed of the Golden Dawn. Nick Griffin, Roberto Fiore of Forza Nuova was the party of the Swedes, so on. And they all contributed essays. And one part that really stuck out was their plan for improving the West's birth rates. What they suggest in the book, in the manifesto, is – or rather, it's a collection of essays, but it's sort of like a manifesto. What they suggest in there is actually to put a tax – on the childless, you know, unless you have like a health – if you have like a health reason or something, no. But if you have no children, you pay more in taxes. So there's – so the benefit isn't the social democrat one of saying, oh, we'll pay you to have children. No. We will fucking punish you for not having children. So what's that going to do? Well, that's sort of what they did in East Germany. And the birth rate blew up women started getting married. And another thing too is they said they have in that manifesto, they say also banning women from attaining higher education until they have children. So you know what, that those kinds of ideas, you know, a MGTOW will look at that and say, oh, but what about the individual? I'm like, well, you know, yeah. I thought you hated women.
The reactionary,
you know,
libertarian.
Why do you hate women? Wouldn't you rather, instead of hating women, wouldn't you rather have a nice wife and a family? You know, I mean, so really the end goal here that you have is to just be a hermit. And essentially, if you're an individual and a hermit and you hate women and you hate, you know, other people and stuff. Well, if you're going to do that, well, you know what? You're useless to society. I don't care how much money you make at your computer programming job.
And that's the practical end result of that ideology, is that, which is why even you see Roosh is like moving away from that now. Roosh is like finding religion and like
180, man. He claims he dropped some shrooms and he said like Jesus talked to him and shit. I hope he doesn't go too far in that direction.
Yeah, I'm a little worried about that myself. But we'll see what happens. I mean,
but what I will say, what I will say though, is that he's been moving away from that for a long time.
He's been on that path for a while.
And I think that's a marvelous.
He doesn't even recommend it anymore.
It's not right. I mean, individual effort is where it all begins. You know, and listen, I'm not judging anyone. I'd be a hypocrite if I did. But you don't. You know, you have to as you mature. You know, part of our problems nowadays is that we never had strong masculine figures to teach us how to deal with women and how to, you know, kind of sync the male energy with the female energy, yeah. You know? So you're expecting, you have to do your part, be good to your woman. Now listen, I've mistreated women in the past.
Let's not go down this women and men rabbit hole right now. We've been going for 3 hours and 10 minutes.
Listen, but I've learned my lesson, but you know, I learned the hard way. And I think that, you know, a lot of these guys, they're just being misled.
I agree.
And we need two things. We need Roosh to maybe curtail a little bit with the mystical stuff and all that. But
he went down that. He's going to go down that path for a bit. We'll see where he goes. But I think, generally speaking, I agree that, you know, the manosphere MGTOW shit has really run its course. It doesn't have much excitement. Like, just like it had a lot of energy, you know, 9 years ago when that stuff really took off, around 2010 or so is when I started really seeing that stuff take off. It seems to have died, and a lot of guys have realized, hey, PUA stuff, whether I was successful or whether I was a failure at it, which a lot of them, let's be honest, I doubt they ever even really applied it. They just love to talk on the internet about it without ever putting any of these theories to the test. Whereas guys that, you know, in my experience, guys that knew how to do it never needed that. But whatever. The PUA
stuff is cringe.
Yeah,
it really is cringe.
It's cringe, but that stuff is all dying, and it's great. I was really happy to see Roosh moving away from that. And you know, I hope he doesn't go down the rabbit hole of this Christian mysticism too far. But we'll see where it goes. But I agree with you that we need to take a look at this.
Point is, we need to we need a
3 hours and 10 minutes.
Oh shit! So I'll finish it up. So what we need really on this front is a revolutionary feminist message. Revolutionary feminists, not the bra burners, but real feminists that love their families and love their femininity. Take identity. What's wrong with being? What's wrong with the identitarianism of your femininity? That's a beautiful thing. It's a great thing, and it's so powerful. Women can do something men can't, which is have children.
The only thing they can thing they can physically do that is totally impossible for a man, no matter what.
Yes, and so you know, imagine having such an amazing
milk too.
Power.
I guess actually a man could do that given enough hormones. But anyway,
so the point I'm making here is that, you know, we're taking identity in that femininity in a revolutionary nationalist fashion, and on top of that, also teaching men masculinity, but the real thing. Not the spurgy math equations of, hey, where can I find the pet store when you go up to like a random chick or something, like, you know, the canned lines and all that, you know, the Matt Forney type of stuff like that. That's just,
it doesn't even work. If you believe that. Well, here's the thing. The PUA community expected you to believe that Matt Forney actually got pussy. I mean, that's how you know it was a fraud. But But anyway, we got to go. It's 3 hours. Right. It's 3 hours and 15 minutes.
Starving.
I'm dying. I got to piss. I'm dying of thirst. I'm dying of starvation. But this is a good show, and we'll pick up maybe we'll have a higher energy discussion of the masculine and feminine stuff when it's not the tail end of the show after 3 hours next week or something.
True that.
All right, I'll talk to you. We'll see everyone next week, and TDS back tomorrow. See you guys.
Take care, Mels.